Good morning. And the Department of Energy and everyone who has come today. Today we're going to deal with the biofuels and the biomass program. Biofuel, not for the first time, but the biomass site, obviously, for the first time. I see here in the program of this committee, around January this year, we did have an update on the biofuel industrial strategy. However, the fact that we seem to be doing a repeat on it is not necessarily to do a repeat on biofuels, it's to have an overall idea of what is being done in the bioenergy sphere as a whole. I'm sure those who know that there are a number of categories and also technologies that obtain in this area, not only biofuels and biomass, but also other technologies. And given that it is part of our work as a committee to have a sense as to what the department is doing in this area, we then felt that let us have a broadened briefing in this regard. But obviously also, when I look at the closing remarks from the department's input in January, I see that there was a concession that there are still a couple of outstanding issues or deliverables which are still working in progress, and that things which require technical investigations. I trust and hope the department will update us on that. Also, there was reference to a cabinet resolution of October 2011, which raised quite a number of things which with regards to biofuels, once again. Amongst other things, it's quite clear that whilst we're focusing on biofuels from an energy perspective, most probably it may be necessary down the line that we engage with the other areas of competency, such as agriculture, such as trade and industry, to ensure that this is an area that we are dealing with in the most comprehensive manner. The other area we expect an input on today is transformation of the gas industry and related matters. I know that once again we did get an update from the department last year. However, I just want to remind everyone that we're not necessarily happy and impressed by the update we got that time. There's some slowness, sluggishness, or whatever you can call it, in that regard. And we really would like to know whether the attempt to which the department has responded to our uneasiness, there is keenness from the industry in this area, more so when we took a visit, was it last week or the other week, to two outlets here in Cape Town, that is two companies which are in the LPG sphere. And definitely this is an area which the committee will keep a keen interest on. Just before we get into the business of tea, I just want to highlight that amongst others, one would welcome responses from NERSA. I trust NERSA is around SALCA as well as the National Treasury, because there are a number of areas when it comes to the biofuels and the biomass issues that would need their responses as we expect. Come again? Okay, shall get apologies from the committee secretary.
Thank you, Chair. The following two apologies, Honorable Maloto and Honorable Tito, who are running late, but they will be joining us, Chair. Those are the apologies. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Shall I hand over now to Mr. Mkhize from the Department of Energy to take us through the briefing?
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair, the committee, the honorable members of the committee, and everyone present here, ladies and gentlemen. I am going to make the presentation. I would like just to apologize upfront that I've got a bit of a flu, and if you am not so clear sometimes, please just bear with me. I will endeavor to make sure that everybody does hear exactly what I'm trying to put forward. I also like to apologize for the my principal that will not make it to the meeting today, and my colleague that is running late because he took a morning flight and he had some problems with the transport of this way, Mr. Kule. I will then start off. I'll make both presentations from my side, which is one on biofuels, as well as go on and talk to the issues of LPG. In terms of my presentation, it's going to be as outlined here, it's going to be the introduction, then look at South African biofuels aspiration, what is it that we as a country wanted to achieve, then look at the update on licensing of biofuel manufacturing facilities, the biofuel regulatory framework, some ongoing and outstanding biofuel starting activities, as well as the cabinet resolutions of 26 October 2011 and closing remarks. In doing that, I will be looking at this will outline the brief historical overview of the biofuels in South Africa, talking to the issue of the evolution of the policy, legislative and research development of the biofuel sector in South Africa, look at what we are currently doing, investments in that regard, as well as the challenges that we face and how we have dealt with that, for example, food security, as well as dealing with the alien crops. And then the socio-economic benefits from biofuels, like jobs, and the potential contribution to supply of energy in terms of the percentage of biofuel energy in the total supply of energy, and how biofuels will help in terms of a reduction of greenhouse gas emissions. First, in terms of the South African context, we've got a biofuels industrial strategy, which was like put into place in terms of creating a link between the first and the second economies, a requirement that entails creating jobs in underdeveloped areas. And then with that, the policy of biofuels, it was recognized that it will require incentives for development. Although they require these incentives, we note that the cost competitiveness with conventional fuels will require that there be financial support, and that financial support will result in the creation of jobs, a positive contribution in terms of balance of payments, as well as energy security in terms of supply and economic growth in a very stable environment. The biofuels industrial strategy of the Republic of South Africa was approved by Cabinet on the 5th of December 2007. That strategy envisaged a 5-year pilot phase, which phase was supposed to be coming to a close this December 2013, if you count from 2008, which is a 5-year period. When we look at the benefits that are needed, with those benefits, I've spoken about they are there to be able to make a better life for all, both now and in the future. The other thing is that from estimates of 2006, when it was developed by the then Department of Minerals and Energy, it revealed that the targeted 2% biofuels scenario can create about 25,000 jobs. I must say that the 22% target is not a 2% concentration of ethanol or bioethanol into a liter of petrol, but it is the penetration of the biofuels in terms of biodiesel and bioethanol into petrol and fuel fuels of the whole country. And that 2% was actually revised down from 4.5%, which was initially proposed in the draft strategic document. The revision considered other things, for example, the fact that you would require subsidies, which would then put some pressure on the fiscal, and therefore one had to look at what is most optimal in terms of setting a target. And also other unintended consequences, for example, what that would do to food security if one exceeds the 2%, because at that point we need then to regroup and ensure that we then formulate a good strategy in terms of taking matters forward, because that would also put some pressure on the food security, water resources, as well as the environment. We note also that, for example, we're talking of 25,000 jobs here, but there is a project that is currently also underway, run by Mabele Fuels, which indicated that it can create, running on 158 million liters per annum of sorghum paper ethanol, it can create between 10,000 to 18,000 direct and indirect jobs to the Free State Province, because they are aiming to have it at the border. The government's intention then was to only allocate the producer incentives to projects that involve expansion that assist in achieving the 2% target, as I was looking at growth and not necessarily those that are already operational in terms of the employment of new people, new employment opportunities, as well as the production, the additional production of biofuels. And then some community ground has been covered in terms of realizing these aspirations, but there are still challenges which I will allude to as I proceed. So, as I said, this 2% by fuel penetration based on about 20 billion liters of petrol and diesel, this is a fuel pool, was about 400 billion liters per annum into the national liquid fuels pool. The objective was to contribute towards the achievement of the national renewable energy policy targets, contribute towards improving security in the country, contribute to the reduction of greenhouse gas emissions, facilitate, among other things, economic development through job creation, small business development, and stimulate agricultural production in underutilized agricultural areas of the country, because we look at it from the point of view that it's not going to use land that is already being used for farming in terms of food, but we know that the old homeland areas where there isn't commercial farming taking place. And then integrate also historical system of farmers, especially in the former homeland, into the mainstream agricultural and energy economies. Having looked at all of that, as it came out, then after we started to issue the licenses, the criteria for biofuel manufacturers, the licensing thereof was put forth, and out of that there were some projects that we have licensed. There are 8 projects in all, one being by Arengo, which is in the Kajok area in the Eastern Cape, where they're looking at the 90 million liters capacity. Then Mabele Fuels, which is Botaville Free State, 158 million liters per annum, and Ubuhle Renewable Energy, which is sugar cane based in the Jozin area, Makatini Flats, and then Rainbow Nation Renewable, which is going to use soybean based for biodiesel, and then Exxon Oil Refinery, which aims to use waste vegetable oil to produce biodiesel, which is in the coastal area, and then Phyto Energy, a kind of waste biodiesel in Port Elizabeth. Then bus 43428 PTY, is waste vegetable oil. At
I think you should slow down a little bit. Yeah. Don't rush, because we really want to understand these things, you know, so that we can elaborate a little bit. It's an interesting area here, that who is licensed, who is not.
Look.
Colin.
Yeah. In terms of all these companies listed here, that if you see that there are some people that are granted and some that are issued, some that you said are in the initial stage of license application. Granted is that the applicant has met all the requirements but is now in possession of the conditional manufacturing license. Issued means the applicant has met all the requirements and is now in a possession of a manufacturing license. I just want to state that if one looks at the figures that exceed the 2% that you will have in terms of what needs to be produced. But of all these companies, none has moved to especially the one that deals with the crops, none have moved to production, to construction, let alone the actual production of the biofuels. Noting that biofuels on their own are not financially viable, so then we have them to do something to incentivize manufacturers of biofuels, which happened immediately after the promulgation of that strategy. And a lot has been said, especially in the media, concerning Arengo, which is an IDC project, which initially was aiming at using sugar beet, but then they are going to start off with the sorghum in this case. So in terms of the incentives, the biofuel pricing mechanism is still being finalized. I will just get to explain the details in terms of that. There is a biodiesel rebate on the general fuel levy, which is 50%. In spite of that, that rebate has not kick-started this industry. Hence, looking at other alternatives to make sure that this industry can kick-start it. The bioethanol itself, when we discussed the matter with National Treasury, was that the bioethanol falls outside of the fuel tax net. And therefore, other ways of incentivizing had to be considered, something which we have done, and I'll talk to later on. There was also a certain depreciation allowance of 50% paid in 20 over 3-year period to have this accelerated depreciation sort of as part also of incentivizing the kick-starting of this industry. I'm saying that despite all this, we don't have production of biofuels. So we need to have more enabling and supportive regulatory framework. When I'm looking at the regulatory framework in terms of what we've done thus far, it's also important that we look at the issue that whatever the biofuel manufacturers are going to produce is going to be taken up by the traditional oil companies. Which oil companies want to be left cost neutral in terms of taking that biofuels for blending? Hence, we have to look at ensuring that there is security of demand that is created, not just supply only. And in terms of security of demand, to ensure that there is an outlet for biofuel that will be produced to go towards the oil companies, is that there was a need for us to have mandatory blending regulations. These mandatory blending regulations were promulgated on the 23rd of August last year in Government Gazette, as shown. They were not given an effective date simply because a lot still needs to be done in terms of creating the proper infrastructure and also having the pricing mechanism so that everyone is clear how much they are going to get out of it, because the industry, also the traditional oil industry, was saying they are not going to be to buy into this unless they are clear that they are not going to end up paying more for this biofuel instead of getting other oxygenate or equivalent products that they can use in terms of their fuel pool. So that regulation is in place and shall come into operation on a day to be determined by the Minister of Energy by notice in the Gazette. The draft regulations were published from 16 September until 18 November for stakeholder comments. Stakeholder workshop was set on the 24th of February and they were promulgated. So now we are looking at the issue of ensuring that they are put into operation. there is an imminent announcement regarding the effective date in view of the delays in finalizing the pricing framework. We're doing that while taking due regard to the fact that this mandatory blending regulation will enable projects that are being developed to go ahead. Because what has been indicated to us is that for example, the funders or potential funders are hesitant to go on with these projects if they are not clear that these regulations are going to be in place. When we had delays with regard to the final the pricing mechanism, we decided that we then need to sit and look at what still needs to be done and have a project plan that deals with it, and then also include some kind of contingency factor and say, and then say that by this time we're going to be done with all the work that is that we have put in place, and we provide adequate time for the construction of whatever infrastructure that is required, and then we put the date, we put forward the date that we are on which we are going to be operational. That date, as I said, is going to be announced. Most probably before the end of this month, but the announcement in terms of the date on which these regulations will come into effect. We have also set up an implementing committee with the industry, both the biofuel industry as well as the, I'll say, the mainly the SAPIA members. We had a meeting on the 26th with the mainly SAPIA to discuss issues that pertain to this mandatory blending and biofuels in general. And the inaugural meeting that we now have all stakeholders is scheduled to take place on the 30th of August. This will go ahead in terms of this implementing committee, which is going to take all the practical implementation aspects of biofuels. And then the cabinet mandated biofuels task team will proceed with this work in terms of all the departments working together in this regard. I just want also to mention that in terms of the regulatory framework, there is work that has been done prior to getting to the biofuels industrial strategy, which work pertains to the petroleum product specifications and standards. The regulations regarding that were promulgated on 23rd of June 2006 in what we now refer to as Cleaner Fuels 1. The amendments to that were promulgated on the 1st of June last year, which looks at Cleaner Fuels 2, looking at them coming into effect in 2017. Those are also supportive of biofuels production. The bioethanol concentration in blended petrol may range from 2% to about 10% on a volumetric basis. This is derived from the oxygenate and volatility specification for blended petrol. The biodiesel will be blended with conventional mineral diesel at concentrations of 5%, 10%, 20%, 30%, 50%, up to 100%, which is the B100 diesel. That is already provided for in the regulation and will continue to be provided for going forward. And also there was an octane number treated measure of 2, which was making it difficult for the inclusion of bioethanol in petrol, which we have, in terms of the discussion document on cleaner fuels 2, is that one that removed, and also to give a volatility waiver for about raise vapor pressure specification. We want to reduce that, because when you put bioethanol, because it is lighter, it causes the vapor pressure to increase, and therefore we want to allow that increase irrespective. So in terms of the fuel specifications themselves, there is the biofuels are accommodated. All right. Then when it comes next, just before I also want to say that in terms of bioethanol, or let me say ethanol in this country, has been used as a PEM, which is a petrol alcohol measure by Sasol in the past. So it won't be something that is new in terms of being used in this country. However, the challenge has been the pricing framework. As I said, biofuels on their own are not financially attractive at the current fuel prices, that is conventional petrol and diesel. We initiated the pricing studies for bioethanol planning value. By this planning value, we mean the value that the oil company would derive from the addition of, or depending of the ethanol versus using any other, the currently used oxygenate, like MTBE, etc. So when we look at that, we had to determine that value. And the other study was to look at the break-even price of producing bioethanol and biodiesel, because we don't want to also to regulate for inefficiencies. We want to bring efficiencies and say what is the most efficient plant that can be run to produce biodiesel or bioethanol, and how much, at what price will then the manufacturer be able to sell at a profit, which profit was based on a return on assets of 15%. That was done in 2011, and it was finished then. We also had a stakeholder workshop to look at the results. The result indicated that this bioethanol, because bioethanol attracts water, it requires some changes in the logistical chain of the company. And as a result, they need to incur additional operational costs, capital costs, as well as some operational costs because of the complex nature when you've got the ethanol in the system. Concerning the break-even price, we're saying that if you've got a break-even price, is that if the oil company is prepared only to pay a price that is lower than the break-even price of the manufacturer, it means manufacturer of the biofuel will be selling at a loss. And therefore, if we want to then get these companies to proceed with the project, we need to subsidize the gap. The oil company won't feel the difference, and at the same time, the manufacturer will be paid the amount that is equivalent to the break-even price. If the break-even price gets higher, gets lower, and the price at which they are prepared to pay, the oil companies are prepared to pay, gets higher, it means then they will have profit. We have the view that as this price that the oil companies are prepared to pay for the biofuel gets higher and higher, there must be a stage where we get some money in payback to the city to cater for the dark days when the price that we are prepared to pay is lower. So that is the principle that is in place. We then saw that there is a gap, and because bioethanol falls outside of the tax net, there is nothing that we do. We needed to create another incentive. Which matter we dealt with in terms of those projects, we submitted the outcomes to National Treasury to engage on this, and National Treasury has since indicated that there is a 3.5 cents per liter to 4.5 cents per liter that needs to be provided to be imposed on all petrol and diesel. And then that money will then be collected, that will be the collection part, and then paid to the biofuel manufacturers. Because with the collection from a bigger pool, it's then going to be paid to, it's going to be larger going to the biofuel manufacturers, which are few, but less in terms of collection, because there are many that are using that diesel and petrol. Those are the discussions that we had with the National Treasury, and we proceeded with the firstly the whole issue was looking at getting that done via our equalization fund, but then in terms of the discussion with National Treasury, we seem to be going the route of general fuel levy. That these are the discussions that we have. What really put the spanner in the works in terms of finalizing the project? We could finalize that end of July, beginning of August, we could finalize that. What put the spanner in the works was that the model that we had used, I'm going to also come later to that, the model that we had used was based on SOCAM. Because we said SOCAM came out the most attractive in terms of the production, but then the production cost. But then what emerged is that other crops, I'll say specifically here, the sugar industry, they were saying that if we cannot enter into an industry that is based on a different crop, because these crops, they go through cycles, and if we invest in that environment, we need to make sure that our crop will also be considered, because then it means that we are just, it's not like we are playing a lottery, because we cannot control or influence or be able to plan properly for a crop that is outside of our base. And then when we then had to investigate it further, because all along we've been miscommunicating with them, because they were always sometimes saying that our seed looks better. And we said, if it looks better, then well and good. If sorghum is not looking as good, because it means you're also going to make a better profit. So we went along with it until there was this realization that the investors are saying, no, if you use another crop, we cannot end. And then we had to look. We had to verify that, because we also talked to the guys that are investing, going to use sorghum as a feedstock. When we discussed with them, they also said, if you use something else, we're not going to partake. We can't invest, because it's a different cycle, it's a different yeast, you know. So that is the main delay in terms of this biofuels pricing framework, the development of. But going back to the issue of how one do the calculation of this, was that we're looking at petrol, 95, the BFP, the basic fuel price of petrol, then we add the zone deals, differential, the fuel tax rebate, plus the blending value, plus that, that will give the price, the delivered price for ethanol. But as I've said, it falls outside the tax net, and therefore cannot be the it does not, qualify for any fuel tax rebate. I also want to say that this blending value is also dependent on the basic petrol price, and can be expressed as a percentage of unleaded petrol BFP. When we looked at all the crops, the most common feedstock, worldwide, are sugar cane and maize. But maize is clearly banned, if I put it like that, from use for biofuels in this country, because of food security challenges. Also, when we looked at in South Africa, grain, sorghum, sugar cane came out as the more appropriate commercial crops. This year I'm saying that because crops are not like maybe buildings where you can build anywhere, because crops, they depend on the vegetation of the area. So in a way, it becomes some kind of an exclusion of others in terms of partaking if one looks at a crop. But at the same time, it needs to be done so that we can get the best value for the money, because this is a subsidized industry. So we noted that there are large quantities of this feedstock that are from local, and this experience to also expand production. And also, we looked at also sugar beet. It has not been grown on a large scale in the country. There is, like as I said, they are all incredible. They are looking at sugar beet. But there is information that exists in terms of it being comparative to the sugar cane if one looks at the sugar concentration in the sugar beet itself, in terms of the content. So the food security and environmental issues were considered as the main solution criteria of these crops. When it comes to biofuels, the biofuels pricing framework, we're looking at the delivered price for biofuels would be based on the gas oil or biodiesel, 50 ppm sulfur, plus zone differential, plus fuel rebates, and then the fuel tax rebate for diesel at 50%, then that gives the price for the delivered biodiesel. The current review removes the 50%, because in terms of the proposal is not to have this general fuel levy rebate, but to look at the subsidy in general. The most common feedstock worldwide for biodiesel are soybean, rapeseed, and to a less extent palm oil. In South Africa, soybeans and safflower seed are the most appropriate commercial crops. Large volumes of these are grown locally and experience is to expand production. Hence, when we look at everything in terms of soya beans, because they are also co-products or byproducts in terms of the soya cake that can do go to animal feed. Soya beans top the others. There is also another crop that people talk a lot about, which is called jatropha. It was excluded as indicated in the strategy. It was excluded mainly because of biodiversity concerns and the need to protect local bird and animal species from poisoning, because jatropha is an alien plant whose leaves and pods are toxic. So that crop is not included and remains excluded. When we looked at these in the evaluation model, is that a 15% return on assets for this program, the 195 cents per liter incentive that is required, and two rand 53 cents per liter that is required for biodiesel if soya is used. The reference plants here are the most optimal plants in terms of liters per annum that need to be set up in terms of the study that was engaged. And the jobs that could be created are as indicated as 8,247 of the reference and then 3,067. The estimated greenhouse gas emissions are 30% compared to normal production in terms of petrol, and also 50% for biodiesel compared to getting that diesel from the mineral or crude oil. That is how these things compare. In terms of this biofuels framework, I must say that we have had a great disappointment, especially with regard to biodiesel, because in the beginning, biodiesel seemed to be the one that can move quicker than bioethanol, looking at the complexities of dealing with bioethanol because of its chemical composition and which leads to its affinity to water. But when we then engage further, we discover that the oil cake that is used for the production of biodiesel can get a better value from the food market, getting it as a cooking oil. Which one would say that if you're taking the cooking oil and what is the equivalent of cooking oil and you make a diesel with it, you are going to get a negative margin. So that is the main thing that we're faced with biodiesel, which in the beginning appeared much easier to do. And we hope that maybe with the development of technology, whether looking at the second generation, third generation technologies, moving from the pilot phase, maybe there will be more, I would say, cost-effective ways of enabling that, so such that maybe one need not go even through the oil cake route to be able to produce the biodiesel. In terms of this year's budget speech, in terms of when the budget review chapter 4, which talks about revenue trends and tax proposals, it clearly states that there is they're looking at this instant industry being supported through a mechanism that will be phased out over an assumed 20-year lifetime of a benchmark plant. The initial cost of the incentive, as I said earlier, would be 3.5 cents per liter to 4.6 cents per liter of petrol or diesel recovered through a levy, included in the monthly price determination. So this is where we are in terms of this work. And as I've alluded here, the causes in terms of the delay earlier on, where we had to look at an alternative means to accommodate other crops while taking cognizance to not to put the fiscal under undue pressure. We then going to use the general field instead of the acquisition fund to collect the money. And then the other thing that we are developing is the criteria for manufacturers of biodiesel to be eligible for the subsidy scheme. That is very important because sometimes companies are eager to proceed with the project and then find that what is promised is not attained. Sometimes through lack of sufficient effort to realize that. So these are some of the things that we do, because it does mean that a person will automatically qualify for the subsidy. We do recognize that these people are getting licensed, and then in terms of this licensing is going to be the main criterion to qualify. But there are other issues that we need to put in place to make sure that we don't get a situation where what is envisaged as a benefit is not realized as a result, or far, far removed from what we have been promised. I think these are the issue there is to, there's some work that still needs to be done. Some of it is work in progress, like providing an update on the, because we're working now as a biofuel task team, which is a cabinet mandated in the Department of Biofuel Task Team, established in 2005, which came up with the strategy and continues to work and looking at the implementation. Part of what the Biofuel Task Team is also doing is to try to support current projects that are working on biofuels. That is one reason why a project, the Aringo project, was considered to be a case study for us to look into and try to support, because it was a government-initiated project being done by IDC and SERF before they pulled out. And then they, in terms of that the different departments are supposed to work on certain issues which I've alluded here, because there's also this second generation biofuels where they needed to provide us an argument for the inclusion or exclusion of that in this at this stage, because in terms of the pilot phase, the second generation and other and third generation the technologies, other technologies, for example, in terms of bioethanol, they're also looking at using cellulose of taking grass and producing biofuels. Those are new technologies that we have said they need to look into and feed back to us. And then supporting emerging farmers in negotiating contracts with biofuel manufacturers, as well as financial assistance thereof, that is done by the forestry and then to provide argument or counter argument on the inclusion of continued exclusion of maize, which are classified in the list of permitted feedstock. That, I would say, has been, in terms of the provision, is that this matter still stands, looking at, in terms of the update, there was this matter still stands in terms of ensuring food security and also eliminating an alien plant that will cause problems overall. And then the ongoing one was to put in the general public knowledge as well as the terms of biofuels. I think that a lot of these things, they hinge on the biofuels pricing mechanism. Because if you don't have the pricing framework mechanism, people are saying we like it, we want to buy it, but we want to know how much are we going to make out of it, how much are we going to save. And the company say we don't want to be negatively impacted by the price, want to remain cost neutral, tell us how much are we going to have to buy this biofuels for. So that's most of the things are hinging on that. I think here, I'll just proceed here, in terms of these, because most of these resolutions that have indicated here, they talk to the table above that I've provided. So I'll say that these outstanding issues are still working for us due to technical investigations, and that some of the investigations have been concluded, like the one that says that we are going to still keep to keep maize out of biofuels, keep Jatofa out of biofuels. Then the other one that we are looking at now is the inclusion of other crops, mainly coming from the issue of sugar industry. As I've said, at the end of the model, we've got the model, we will also look at how this model can be availed generally to the players, so they can be able to look if they are meeting the targets. And then the other thing is that although this industry is not, its influence, one can also argue, is not even taken off, it does possess long-term potential growth. But I think it's also important for us to look at the upside and downside issues in other words, also look at when things work well for the industry, when things don't work well, because we don't want a situation where there is subsidy to help the industry, but when the industry is doing exceptionally well, there is money paid back to the heat. I think we don't want that kind of a situation. So this is just a closing remark on my side and saying that we will be having that implementation workshop on the 30th, or a meeting on the 30th of August, which will deal with all the practical aspects. Once we are engaging with National Treasury to finalize the issue of crops, the inclusion of crops, which I said in the main is sugar cane, because we don't want to, sugar cane was also talked to the issue of cogen. All those issues will not be looked separately, but to look at them all together, because when we're dealing with the pricing mechanism, we also consider byproducts from that. We should be in a position to finalize, this is the problem, that these things are more of investigation, but we should be able to finalize all of this before the end of the third quarter of the year, in terms of by food pricing framework, which is most, almost everything hinges on it. The date, I cannot make any pronouncement on the date that will be dealt with by my principal. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Kiza. Well, I see there's a lot of cut and paste in the presentation from the one in January. It's a bit interesting one of them, because obviously we do monitor things. We don't just call you without checking what has been presented in the past. Of course, I'll allow members to come up with their questions and clarity seeking. Welcome to all the members in Tindo that Loto, and welcome to Honorable Steve from the Portfolio Committee on Agriculture, keeping a hawk's eye on us. Of course, we welcome your comments, because you've seen some references made to a couple of things. Very, very much welcome. Anything that will add value to our hands here. All members, the floor is yours. Let me see hands. Welcome, Bunga. Oh, my father is as well. This is a very unfriendly venue. In fact, that is. Okay. Over to you.
Thanks, Chair. I do have a number of questions, but I just wanted to seek some clarity, because this is a very complex issue, and I understand the complexities around that. And I remember discussing the strategy 6-7 years ago, and we don't seem to have made much progress since then. But I understand that there has been issues and things needed to be worked out, stuff like that. But still, what I'm trying to get my head around, though, is this subsidy that you talk about. So you're talking about a 3 to 4 cents a litre subsidy. Now, I presume that's on all petrol and diesel that is sold in the country. It's not just the ones that sold from a kind of bioethanol plant to the refinery. It's not just that 3 or 4 cents a litre on that 2%. It's on the entire country sales. So we're talking about a subsidy in the order, which is probably quite a large number now. But I see it as not so much as a subsidy, but as a kitty that you talk about, that either gets drawn upon at times when the price is below what bioethanol producers and biodiesel producers can get for their product. Is my understanding right in that regard? And at times when it's above, that actually money gets put into the kitty. I just wanted to get clarity on that. And related to that is, what is the relation and or the break-even point for, say, bioethanol plant in terms of the basic fuel price? Because obviously the basic fuel price is fluctuating the whole time in terms of global machinations. But that fuel price also has a bearing on the feedstock price as well. So, you know, so as the price of fuel goes up, so does the price of feedstock coming to that bioethanol plant. So I'm just interested, if you could just give us some clarity as to how those all relate, what's the break-even point, and at what stage does that subsidy have to kick in, at what stage does that kitty get replenished? If you can just give me some clarity around that. And just then, the other issue in terms of sorghum and sugarcane and those issues, I mean, you know, when we did a study term, this is about 7 years ago now, I think, to Brazil to look at their biofuels industry, I mean, clearly sugarcane was their choice. I mean, that was their main crop around that. But my understanding is that we've got very little space left for more sugarcane production in South Africa. So we would probably be taking some crop that has already been used for another purpose and putting that into that. Whereas I think possibly what we want to try to do with the biofuel strategy is to encourage new land, new emerging farmers, new areas to be cultivated so that we don't then compromise on food security and we actually get benefits beyond just existing farmers and just using some of the existing crops. I'm just interested to see what your comments are with regards to that. And then just lastly on the biodiesel, I mean, you know, also when we were in Brazil, that seemed to be the most promising aspect, particularly around emerging farmers. I think there was about 1 million farmers were helped through the biodiesel program in Brazil, and they said that this is particularly good for small-scale farmers because, in fact, that people could grow it on a very small amount of land and they could supply it to a refinery. So I was a bit perturbed to hear you say that, in fact, it doesn't seem to be that attractive in South Africa, that, in fact, biodiesel crops are used for other purposes. I'm just interested, I presume you obviously have looked at the Brazilian experience, but how did they do it in Brazil? How did they impact encourage such a program, and what kind of subsidies were offered in that regard? Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Sma. Jay, thank you. My sentiment goes with Honourable Grayling on the time frames and the implementation of this whole issue going forward. My concern is that the department is not, we are making reference to the third quarter, but we're not trying to put any time frames to actual plan. And I would like to understand from the department, why are you so hesitant to put some time frames in place so that we actually can hold yourself accountable to those time frames? Yes, this is a difficult topic, but I think when we look at the break points of this product or ethanol or biofuels, I think we also need to look into consideration the break-even point of the other liquid fuels products. So when we go forward, we are saying how much and how far are we asking the consumer to subsidize this product. We do know, like some of our green energy products, that some of the green energy and products is not as cost effective as others, so therefore cost subsidizing do take place in order to give us the CO2 levels that we are looking for. I did a rough calculation on the 3 point the fuel levy between 3 and 4.5 cents. It comes to about 9.2 billion rand, if my calculations are right, to about 230 million litres of fuel, of petrol and diesel that are being sold annually. And the total cost or total production capacity should all 8 license holders get to stage where it's approved. We would then look at 1 million, and which will give us a rough figure of a 2.5 billion rand cross subsidy. My concern is the balance, or the balance of that, of the 2.5, if my estimate, and then I'm working at a 2.50 rand per liter cross subsidized of a billion liters. That then is cross-subsidized. Then there's the balance from that to the 9.2 that I'm trying to get to. And what is the intention of the department with that? Are we trying to put provisions in place for capital development by this industry, and then incentivize incentivize for the building of this hugely expensive capital programs that will be outrolled by these individuals, and for what time frame? Because at some point, are we looking at an indefinite cross-subsidy, or are we saying to a point of 5 years that enough is enough, and by that time you should have some sort of a capital return, and not a full capital return? When I add your capacity per liters per annum, and I look at the and I look at the 1 billion towards the 4 million liters of 400 million liters that are in total capacity, but when I look at the we had a presentation the other day, and total petrol and diesel sales are 229 million liters within the South African market. And I look at the percentage thereof, and possible licenses that are going to be awarded to. And should all 8 be guaranteed of a license, and they do come up and running, we are looking far beyond 2% of the actual market. We then look at 4 to 6%. My question is this: has the department done a cost analysis on what it will cost refineries to change technical specs in order to take up a 4 to 6% above the 2% now? Because now we're moving to another sector. Have we actually done that? And are we looking to incentivize those industry in order to co-opt the uptake greater than 2%? Because currently 2%, according to the industry, is acceptable and can be managed. But if we go beyond the 2% and we allow for more role players to come on board, we either need to export the product, or we either need to relook at the actual 2% uptake and how we're going to deal with that. And if we're only going to regulate to a 2% or require companies to take a 2% uptake, then I see economic feasibility problems to some of these industry role players in getting to their full potential. Okay, my other concern is that this product, biofuels or bioethanol, is heavily rested on the agriculture market. And the agriculture market has got its ups and downs, depending to weather circumstances, beginning to price increases. And it's twofold that where my worry is. Has the department done a study to determine if farmers will diversify their crop mix, being more profitable, I will produce less on the one side in order to compensate a little bit on the other side because of a better return on hectares, secondly, should the biofuels industry and a playing devil's advocate here fall into a risk and cannot produce the volumes that it should, which we see in other states, like in America, where shortages do appear because of seasonal crops or whatever happens. Are we expecting, because it's our mandatory obligation by the refineries to do a 2% uptake, are we then going to expect our national carrier, Petro-SA or through NASA, then to uptake or to buy in the shortcomings? Who's going to be held liable for any short product produced up to the 2%? Should the industry fail to do that? Because currently we've got Eskom, and Eskom has got a stand mandate for any renewable energy shortcomings for energy supply, and there should be a backup system. In this case, who's the backup system? and who then or where will the funds come in order to back that funding? I'm just wondering if the department has thought that through. Are we going to say to PetroSA, you've got to buy in from somewhere else, or are we going to say to the industry to buy in? Because when we do the buy-in, Chairperson, it goes a little bit wider. Then we've got to look at the storage capacity, and there are other technical problems that comes with it. But I'm not going to take too much time on it. I think I'll allow other colleagues to have a bite on it this time or another day. We can go on with this, but again, thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you, Mr. Mkhize, for the presentation. On slide 5, about the former homelands, it is quite a good idea. But I wonder if any of this places were looked at or into that they are able to really grow this crops that's needed. Then on slide 6, there's this granted and issued. I didn't hear you properly. What you said, is it already amongst them, is there any that has already started planting or growing the crops for biofuels? Then you spoke about treasury, that treasury will be giving subsidizing this farmers. Are these people going to start growing before now, or are they going to wait for the treasury to subsidize them? Thank you.
Chair, I think it's women, but this time it's not for
I'm telling the meeting, but I think Kamala is really a woman, man. Where are my two stand in front of us?
Thanks, Robert Chair. I'm going to pick up on what the other two honourable members, Kreni Asmani, have spoken about, particularly on the clarity on the subsidy. Is this three supporters? I really want an answer as to whether the subsidy will end up being an indefinite subsidy. Okay? And I know that Mr. Mkhize said he cannot make pronouncements on the dates and so forth, but we do want to know what are the plans and what are the time frames. Because if you're not working towards something like that, we're just working very open-ended. Chair, biofuel is a very strange animal because it both is an energy solution, but it's very agriculturally dependent. We spoke a lot about the small-scale farmers, about historically disadvantaged areas. We spoke about job creating. What job study has been done? How is this going to come about? Who's going to be monitoring that? How are we going to ensure that the small-scale farmers actually do grow? Because given that this is sitting in agriculture and not in energy, how do we marry the two, and how do we make sure that the departments continue to work together? The other thing is that I'd just like to know what are the outcomes of the biofuel water policy, because there had been a conversation with the Department of Water and Environment and all the other departments, and what was the outcome from that. And very, very importantly is about the crop rotation. Food security is being spoken about all over the world. And are farmers going to see producing crops for biofuel an easier option as to producing crops for food? And I think we really need to look at that and whether we're going to be using, we do say that we're not going to be using sort of existing food-producing farms. But who's going to monitor that to make sure that that's not going to happen? and because I think it's an important issue to look at. I think this is an excellent initiative, but I also just think that flags that come up the water, the food security, and will there be farmers that might just take an easy option on. Thanks very much, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. No, Chair, I just want to say to Kazela, I'm grateful that one of the objectives stipulate that this issue of biofuel is a contributory, you know, element in terms of the achieving the national renewable energy, but also, you know, going to try and improve the energy security in the country. If we can just, you know, stick into those particular two objectives, I think it will be able also to come to give us the clarity. Because it mustn't be as if this bifuel is a replacement of the fuel industry as a whole. But my appeal to you, Kabazan, and the department, that as we continue to try and stimulate the agricultural production that is regionalized, and ensuring that at least you engage with the former homeland, try and ensure that you involve the Amakhosi to ensure that you don't find yourselves being in one of the controversial aspects. And try and ensure that at least all those people that are within those different areas are being involved deeper in terms of participating in the SMEs. Because that's what we want to see. People within those areas benefiting in that aspect. But surely, it is true that our members are mentioning that we know that there will be a challenge in terms of the shortage of the feedstock. If you remember correctly, around the 1990s and the early 2000s, there was a challenge in terms of the shortage of maize. What study have you made in ensuring that that challenge doesn't just arise again just because people will be rushing towards being subsidized by government and ensuring that they get into the biofuel industry? The other issue, Chair, relates to the IHS when Mr. is there. In his conclusion remarks, he was mentioning that this industry has a long potential growth. But I'm just trying to check. I was just reading some of the other newspapers recently. People mentioning that licenses for mining are being distributed all over. And these mining rights also targets some of the fertile lands, especially, you know, in Gert Valley. It's one of the agricultural sites. Apparently, there's also a coal that people are mainly targeting to ship out of the country. I'm trying to check in terms of when you say it's got a long potential growth, what do you mean by that? Because also, the issue of issuing of licenses to mining is going to hinder a very serious challenge in terms of people using those land. You must be able also to clarify in terms of that. Let me leave the rest to other members. Thank you, Chair.
Anyone else? Okay, Honourable
Chairperson, I was just wondering from the department, looking at the 2% blending, is there been any thought about where blending should be taking place? Are we looking to take the blending at refineries? Are we looking at taking the blending to depots of the downstream industry? And how would you, as a department, then regulate the quality of that blending, taking into account that diesel is not regulated currently within the province? within the country, and should we then look at coming up with better regulation around the quality of that product? And is this a role where NERSA should be playing a role in, or would you see SAPIA, the actual petroleum industry, looking at playing in that, taking into consideration that we're going towards Euro 5 standards that we would like to achieve by 2017. Thank you.
Martin?
Thank you, Chairperson. I just want to ask a question. I was covered by the question from the colleagues from the portfolio on energy. I'm happy that they're thinking about the food security issue. Chair, on this slide where the 8 licensing facilities is on, I don't know which page it is, 6, it says plant type, the NFS. Does it mean that those specific plants will only be producing that specific type, or what would happen if they want to change to something else? And it links to some of the questions here. You know, certain areas, certain years, something is not growing well, then you want to do something else. So will they only be able to use that specific commodity in that plant? And then the other concern, Chair, that I'm having, and it's also linked to the fact that we are looking at unproductive land at the moment, but if you look at where these plants are situated, it's not really near all these areas of land. And maybe the last question from Honourable Smalek would lead to that, because if you look at the areas where the plant is situated, it's not near to this unproductive land. So how did you get to the specific areas, the approval of those specific areas?
Well, I'm here, I think it's at 10 now.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you very much, members, for the question. I'm not going to sit here and be like defending biofuels at all costs, no. I appreciate this question. I'm also going to highlight it because as long as we know what potential problems exist and we devise mechanisms to deal with them, the better it's going to be. When it comes to the issue of the term that we are looking at, maybe start off with the subsidies. In the slide that I had provided on, I'll say the pricing framework as articulated under this budget review chapter 4, which look at a period of 20 years in terms of the amortization of those plans. And I do appreciate that 20-year period is a long period. We are still going to get to 20 years with our democracy. So it is a long time, but that is a time that has been put forth as a time to pay the amortization of those plans. In the prices that we're looking at in terms of the BFP, the pricing mechanism, we've got monthly adjustment of these prices. They're monitored on a day basis, but adjusted on a monthly basis. So this initially, the thinking was around putting them on a monthly basis. As I said, it's going to compensate for monthly movement in benchmark, feedstock, and output prices. But the issue is that let's look at it in terms of the general fuel levy. Both if it's a general fuel levy, it's going to sit there. They can be those budget adjustments that will talk to where this pricing mechanism is moving towards or where the prices are moving towards. Provide some gap to accommodate so that you don't run out of money in the kit. You are right in terms of saying that this money is going to be collected from a larger base, all users of petrol and diesel, and then distributed to the few. The consideration here was that what happens is that, as I've spoken about the blending value of bioethanol, is that the bioethanol price, then the price at which the oil company is prepared to buy is linked to the BFPE. So then, because the oil company says, and as far as the commission does far, I'm prepared to buy this, but leave me cost neutral, because it's displacing some component in my petrol. I can get by putting the bioethanol, but let me remain cost neutral. That is why we're saying that if the existing does not stay the same, because it should move with the BFP. And then you see, as not necessarily on a one-to-one basis, but there is a relationship, a price relationship. So as the oil company says, I'm prepared to buy here, but this guy says, for me to be profitable, I need to sell at this price. Then that's the price, that is the part that is being covered. And it goes on like that, right? So there is an adjustment of the price in line with that. You can be forward looking and put a little bit more, you know, so there's always money in the heat. Those who ever said we are going to look at it from a general theory adjustment perspective. And then in terms of the amount, because we talked of the 2%, I just want to ensure that there is clarity here. There is a 2% concentration per liter of petrol, and then there is a 2% penetration. In terms of the 2%, for example, if you want to have 2% penetration, you can achieve 2% by 10% per liter and still come up with 2% national. It's a concentration. It's like if you've got 200, let's say you've got 100, and then you've got 20 liter bottles, you can put 2% of that 20 liter, or you can simply put 2 in 120 liter, and then put 0 the rest, you still get to 2%. So there's a concentration issue in terms of biofuel. The concentration can be 2 to 10, 2% to 10% on a volumetric basis. What we looked at is that when the study was done, it indicated that the blending value, although negative, is best at 2%. Then it worsens at 5% and kind of recovers at 10%. So most of the time, the natural response would be to try to get 2% volumetric basis in terms of the concentration. So then the 2% becomes the same as the 2% penetration that you keep talking about. And it can happen, let's say for example, nothing, there's zero on diesel, for example, which means that the 2% of bioethanol is going to be more than the 2% if one excludes diesel. Because no biodiesel is going to be, I'm saying just for example, if it's the kind of a scenario. That is an issue that we have said is to close the monitor, because the target, we've put the target to be 2%. And what we should, there are certain criteria, it doesn't mean that all these people that are because they've not even started building this plant will automatically qualify. And that is why we are also having this implementation committee to look now at the, we've outlined the practical aspects of implementation, but just at a high level. Now we need to zoom in and deal with the implementation aspects now much more in detail in this implementing committee. The BTT, which is the Biofuels Task Team, is a departmental one. Because this work, in fact, it just so happens that because of the nature of age, there is hardly a thing that you can do as Department of Energy sitting in your own corner. You need to engage all other players, most of the players. And therefore, this BTT should continue its work, not only now as developmental or facilitating the industry, but being able to do the monitoring in terms of the compliance, hence the need for these criteria that we're talking about. In terms of the cost-benefit analysis and all that, those that has been done as part of the package that National Treasury looked at in coming up with what is sitting in the budget review. As I've alluded to the fact that had it not been this concern around the issue of additional crops, we would have made announcement by now, we would have considered the issue of the price, right, based simply on that. And if I go to the issue of the sugar cane, in terms of the scope for new business, is that we also engage them quite a lot. I had several engagements with the sugar industry around that. They're saying that there is there is land that is currently not utilized, which they will then they will have to use, and then have like as they do have in Brazil, where there is you got the plant, then you switch to the sugar or to ethanol and can have them going at the same time. So that they said they can have that, and they can have also other improvements, which also link to the issue of cogeneration in terms of the production of electricity. That is why we need to look at it together. But we would look at those specific issues, and those conditions will be contained as part of the criteria for them to qualify for the subsidy. So they can say whatever they want to say, but those criteria will ensure then that they do get into the scheme via doing the right thing in terms of creating new opportunities. They're also looking at, when I discuss with them, also saying that they're also looking at issues, for example, like green harvesting, because they will take the whole sugar cane, let them take the technology and not bend the sugar cane and just take the stock only. Take all of that and use it for cogen as well as also use it for biofuel. So, the period of harvesting will be lengthened as a result of going the route of biofuels. And then that is how then those jobs will come into being, looking at all of those things. We're not just going to take them as provided to us. We need to look and say to whether these things are really done as indicated. In terms of the incentives in Brazil, because we engage with them, it was more on a technological R&D web that we look at them, whether we're looking at various the feedstock in terms of how to use the oil cake as well as the seed itself in terms of production. But as you also noted, that Brazil is not that big also in terms of biodiesel. They are big in terms of bioethanol, the sugar cane. And their vegetation and the whole climatic conditions allow them to have sugar cane without irrigation. So that from that point, they do have the kind of a benefit. When it comes to us giving the time frame, as I said that we were dealing with National Treasury and we're supposed to have concluded that. Not that one is not giving the time frame, the time frame, because I'm saying that I'm putting a target of saying before the end of third quarter should have concluded the MEC. I'm saying this because there's a lot of to-ing and fro-ing in developing this, and also that it involves the different team members. We have already draft documents that deal with these matters. For example, the criteria draft documents, the draft is out there for people to still comment. So sometimes we expected people to comment within a week. There are time frames that were put from a project management perspective. But as we understand that sometimes people not return things as early as you want, and so that is why I'm just putting this in. But it is a matter that we want to get it concluded as soon as possible. The blending in terms of any place, anywhere blending, there is a blending that we're looking at in terms of blending in the refinery itself, as well as blending at the blending facility at the depot. So those alternatives are out there and are going to be threshed out in terms of this implementation plan. But the work that was done includes both to see how much effect would be required if you're doing it at the depot, or doing it at the refinery. On the other hand, the closer you are to the market, the better, because of the attraction of water by ethanol. And then the oil companies, just wanted to say that how we looked at it is that when it comes to the oil companies taking up the biofuel, they are saying, as I said, on the river cost trial, we'll buy this for blending purposes. Now, when the mandatory blending regulation, if there is no stock to blend with, there is no biofuel, then the oil company is absorbed from any problem, because the mandatory blending is subject to the availability of the biofuel. So then it's not a problem for the oil company. For the country, it's also the fact that we would like to get that production taking place in the country, the justification being the issue of jobs. And indicated, we've indicated that we won't look at the importation, right, upfront. But when a person is, when they're saying things like maybe major droughts or whatever, there would be importation for that, for just that short period, right? But we're looking at the production, because the main justification for this is also from the part of creating jobs, looking at the total value chain of the biofuels. Then when it comes to the, the dependence on the agricultural market in terms of fuel switching, crop switching, the land that we have looked at in terms of this project coming in is that they need to have subsistence farmers as part of the project. We're not saying that the subsistence farmers are going to necessarily wait for National Treasury to make announcement. There are certain things that the industry would require as a market signal from the department for them to do certain things. For example, in the beginning, industry told us, if you put the regulations out there, monetary regulations, we will go ahead. But then later on they said, no, we can only go ahead if there is an effective date, because what our funders require. So I think here there is already agreements that are in place with potential producers of the crop in terms of the submission of applications for these companies. But for things to go to proceed, the issue of the funding needs to come. The pricing mechanism needs to be out there. But it's somehow it is a chicken and egg situation, but there is work that can be done prior to the finalization, not just sitting and waiting and doing nothing until National Treasury announces something. I think I've spoken to the issue of the unavailability of the product. When it comes to the people the question around the slide talking to granting as well as this slide here, sorry. The granting is that we said that the granting means the applicant has not met all the requirements but is now in the position of a conditional manufacturing license. Just to say, please do 1, 2, 3, we're going to issue the license. The others are issued with the license. I noted that not all of them are necessarily in those areas that are said to be unproductive in the past. But one of the things is that it's a question of where the crop is sourced, where some of the crop is sourced in those areas. Because they cannot rely on it. It doesn't mean that all of them have put forth a provider of the feedstock. There are different suppliers of the feedstock for them. The other thing is that how would we ensure that small scale farmers do really grow? There it is a question of the Department of Agriculture as well as the under the auspices of the biofuels task team being able to enable that. In the same vein, the issue of assuring that there is no negative impact on water and food security needs to be an ongoing thing and included in the criteria, because we cannot go on and subsidize some activity that jeopardizes food security as well as the water situation in the country. In terms of the energy security in the country with respect to biofuels, whilst biofuels play an important role, I think we just need also to be cognizant of the fact that, as I said, is 2%. There could be a lot of downside when it is above 2%, issues we need to look into. It does play a role in terms of security of supply, but it's not so much of a significant role as to the development of the agricultural, the agro businesses, as well as the whole job creation issue in the country, as we've spoken about the 50%. And we will We appreciate your input in terms of us involving AMACOS and involving COOPTA. And I think that should also be more, put more impetus on that once we have announced the pricing framework. And the other thing is that the long-term, by long-term growth potential, what I meant there is that once this is kick-started, there are going to be teething problems. But in terms of the job creation potential, there is a huge job creation potential if all goes by the numbers. And then also they will understand the environment better, because this is starting a new industry which is not a simple matter as such, but will then understand things and be able to sort out those teething problems, and then the development can then be huge, as we've seen in the Brazilian situation. But there are many factors that one needs to also consider in the development. In terms of the, maybe the last one is that in terms of the plant type, we said there's a sorghum based by ethanol, for example, plant, there's a sugar cane based one, Indozini. When we look at those plants, they are designed in such a manner that they are able to handle that plant, that kind of crop. If a different crop needs to be used, then there must be changes or modifications done in the, to the plant. So we take it that they will continue with that crop and not necessarily switch, because there comes with some switching costs associated with that. And we won't preclude someone from switching a crop, as long as the criteria is met. Thank you, Chair. If there are some tough people, I'll respond.
One from me. Thanks very much for now.
Your response is lengthy, but it reflects the extent of interest from members and the way they are applying their minds to this sector. Currently, according to Professors Van Zyl and Pryor, who are part of the research initiative at Stellenbosch, I understand they are part of the international the Energy Agency program. They say there are more than 200 small entrepreneurs that produce biodiesel on small scale, mostly from waste vegetable oils. My interest is that how do you factor them in? Because at this stage in time, we've been talking about these big ones, 8 and also Sapia, and they pick up a couple of concerns from those entrepreneurs around feedstock, uptake, but of course at that stage, that was 2009, so there was no mandatory blending, which I can say you're addressing. And another interesting area was meeting specifications required by petrochemical industries. But I think more than anything, it's this angle from small entrepreneurs, you know. I think another area for me is that why the 50% rebate incentive not worked? Sorry if you had explained it, but it's interesting because it's one thing to just you know, come up with one incentive you know, after another. But I remember when I was still a trading industry owner members, you know, trading industry, Department of Trade and Industry revamped the whole incentive regime. But when they took us through, they explained, you know, which worked, which didn't work, which needed, you know, the rationale behind the refinement, that we have to capture it in that way. So one would be interested as well to say, what's the rationale behind the, you know, the refinement there? And also, if you could take us through a little bit on your implementation committee. Who is in the implementation committee? I tend to be tempted to say that maybe next time when you come, it should just be the department, it should be the implementation committee, so BTT, because there are a number of aspects and angles for which this thing gets, handled. Anyway, Honorable Smiley still had an additional question.
No, thank you, Chair. I'll start with the last one that was put by the department of switching crop.
I've got a concern when you allow a manufacturer to change their license agreement, because it actually it's a license agreement that's been done beforehand on the actual crop, which goes coincide with some studies that protects certain industries, and to be able to switch it at either a very late stage after being approved or much later, I need to understand that logic. So I do not agree with the 2% explanation that you did, and I probably will talk outside this meeting on trying to understand it. My concern of being with a sort of indefinite subsidy of 20 years, because that's about indefinite as it can get, to build a plant is in a region of 2 to 3 billion rand, depending on what type of plant you're going to put up. If the department is going to save around about 5 billion rand or more per annum on the fuel levy, on this 4%, this is my concern here. How much of the capital development are we trying to assist in paying these developers? More than 30%? The 400%? Because it's not making sense, sir. Are we trying to repay to a certain point and let the consumer carry on? It just doesn't justify that answer, and maybe at another time, if we haven't got the figures and the explanations, you would like to come back to us and explain that to us in a better manner. I will be open to that endeavors, and I think if you would allow us to take this in the committee at another level where we can scrutinize certain of these, why certain incentives didn't work, how does it actually go towards this? Chair, because I'm asking this because if we're looking at 2% of penetration market and we look at the number of license holders that there are, it is impossible to stay at the 2% uptake. And if we are saying to, and if there are only one or two one currently a refinery that is actually willing to go in an uptake agreement of a 5-year plan or a 10-year uptake by a consumer, how do you then allow later applications to come on board when refineries, because you really say that the scale of the uptake 2% is high, when it comes to 5% it becomes non-profitable, and then the curve goes up again. So this is very high stakes for refineries, and no refinery is going to go at the down spiral at 5% and making that loss or get into a situation where it loses that mindset. And that is my effect because that's where the real cost analysis is coming in. When you say 2%, everybody takes up, but when it comes to 5% and that increases dramatically, then the incentives that was paid off the 15% on page 16 of this presentation talks about 1.93 and 2.53. Those are the incentives that we are looking at. Then to subsidize that down spiral of 5%, hoping that it will get again up to 8 to 10%.
Thank you very much, the Honorable State. Kavazela, over to you.
Thank you, Chairperson. First, I would just like to say that the in terms of the small enterprises, we are still engaging some of the people that are working on specially used oil. Because if you look at this one, it was mainly from the viewpoint of the crops being able to also boost the agricultural sector and the employment figures that are related to that. We are engaging the people that are using waste vegetable oil and other oils. For example, last month I had a discussion with a meeting with people from the Northern Cape looking at the bison diesel that are looking at biodiesel manufactured from the use. But their challenge is that they are also looking at the importation now of that cooking oil, because here there isn't enough supply that will sustain that kind of an industry and the growth that they envisage. So we are in discussion with them, although they are not they don't necessarily fit that well in terms of this, from the point of the job creation and all these other aspects. But it is an issue that we are looking on the side and assisting them as much as we can. I'm still going to engage them further in terms of looking at their economies and everything. I would say that the 50% incentive has not worked. I think the main, as I alluded earlier on, that with biodiesel, the challenge is that they can derive better margins from the oil cake in the human market than converting that oil cake into biodiesel. So that has also said to be a decent incentive on their part. I think it would help maybe just before we take the issue of the biofuels pricing framework out into the public domain, maybe that we also engage with the somehow, I don't know how, maybe the committee, so that we can look into the details and put the numbers up there and look at the models itself to debate those issues and be able to cross-examine them so we can come up with a more refined kind of framework. The implementation committee comprises the biofuel industry as well as the oil companies which are going to uptake this product, biofuels for blending. From time, it might expand, some people will come maybe in as and when required. In terms of going to look at the practical issues, like where do you blend, how long it will take to put up the required infrastructure for all that. It may be SAPIA members that are going to be there, and I would say then the biofuel industry. And it so happens that some of the biofuel members are biofuel industry players are already SAPIA members due to the expansion of the SAPIA membership. And then the switching of crops. If I'm talking of switching of crops, I'm not saying I'm talking about a willy-nilly expansion switching. It is a switching that does follow due process. Because what we do from our side, we don't base this on someone's plant. There is a typical plant that we base this on. And then if the other guy is operating inefficiently, he will then have to select a loss. If he operates it efficiently, then he will make a profit based on this plant. This plant remains the same going forward, irrespective of what this guy does. If a person ends up saying, I want to switch, and then he switches, but he doesn't make a profit, it's him that must bear that risk. But we are regulating for efficiency. When it comes to the 2%, 5%, and 10%, I just want to clarify that, just exactly, Chair, that we've got, I was talking about the 2% concentration, where, for example, let's say I'm a biofuel manufacturer, which is a biofuel. Then there's Company X. Company X wants to buy from me. And then I say Company X, we agree with Company X that I'm going to put 10% per liter. That 10% is an agreement between us. It's a bit more costly for him than the 2%. So, but overall in the country, it can happen that deal translates to 2% if other plants are included. But actually, I put 10% concentration, not 10% penetration. I think those two are different. So I was talking about that on a liter basis to say if you move from 2 to 5% on a liter basis, this the value decreases and start to become better. This is based on what we saw when we're doing the model, when it is 10%. So that is why I was talking about this 2%, 10%. And we are saying that as from a subsidy viewpoint, we will take a stance that we have got 2% penetration countrywide and 2% per liter. If you on your own decide to make it 10% for whatever reason, because you don't want to transport your product very far to make it 2 here and 2 at another table, that is your issue that you want to sort out with, but the subsidy stands at 2%. If now we need to increase, we can have a situation, say for example, now it's beyond 2%. We don't assume 2% on a per blend basis. We assume 2 and we assume 10. So then on a concentration, we assume 10, but actually it's 5% additional. So that we try not to pay, to unduly pay more in terms of subsidizing, because this curve is not a flat line or a line. It's got a parabolic, so to say. Yeah. So this concentration and penetration issues are not necessarily the same, although sometimes we tend to speak as if they are the same thing. Thank you.
Penetration versus concentration.
Chairman, my question is this, because now you will have company X or refinery X that won't take up. Because we're looking at the whole picture, and then one company will make up for the other three companies that, you know, that doesn't take up the uptake. And but the subsidy, if I understand it correctly, will only be for the first 2%. Above the 2%, no. If company X takes 10% from me, do I get subsidized for the 10% that I've given, or do I get subsidized up to a specific margin, which could be 2%?
Thank you, Jim. Company X shall take whatever is given to him to the level of 2%. Company X is obliged to do that by law. It is then the question of enforcement of that. Company Y does not take up what Company X has refused to take per se. I'm thinking now in terms of the law. It will be the enforcement problem that comes in today. Now, we're saying we're at 2% and we're paying the subsidy for 2%. And then if we go to beyond 2%, that is why we need to have the monitoring. Implementing and the PTT playing the monitoring role now, looking at now the aspect now, because we need to quickly get back to the table to say now people are going to go beyond the 2%. We've been told, for example, roughly, that it doesn't take less than 18 months. It won't take less than 18 months for these players to construct their plants and get them operational. During which period, we will see who are really going on constructing their plants, and then be able to also do the right studies to be able to say beyond 2%, what is it that must be done? Because we're saying that in terms of the criteria will have to be relooked once the 2% is exceeded or at the point of exceeding the 2%. So it is a problem that I would say in current situation, it is a problem that we will welcome.
Thank you very much,
Thank you very much, honored members. I think we're trying to close now on this one so that we can take a break. But just close the comments. I must say, some of the job prospects in this sector are attractive enough for us to invest some time on it. However, representing such prospects and others, and of course, related benefits in nurturing this infant industry, there is unfortunately, you know, strange history around this infant industry. The first thing is that, according to what Mr. Kiza said, there was a strategy adopted in 2007, phase one, which was supposed to have been reviewed, and by now
Emaphonemetable strategy program coming out. And in my view and observation, since it's taking longer than expected to take strategy to higher levels. Of course, when handling an insurance industry, there are a number of expectations from the government in particular. And I don't seem to be picking up clearly as to what's the government strategy here. Of course, that's being spearheaded by the department. A good example is that when I just picked up something from people, from academics who are, you know, operating in this area, and to my surprise, I found that there was not included now in the presentation the West Asia Group, or 200 small entrepreneurs. And we are part of the pool that also is supporting SMEs, including those two. I mean, I don't say that we should run full speed to support them if there's no need for now, but at least mention should have been done around that, so that we have to be about what is being done in the biofuel industry as a whole. Definitely a comprehensive approach is very essential. And given that the issue of biofuel touches food security, very, very sensitive and emotional issue, that even reinforces my suggestion that there should be two nodding between the department and us. Or maybe let me say one of the members, the biofuel task team. Because it would be helpful as well to see what the other commoners of the task team are saying, what their role is. Probably at some stage, it would also be helpful that we explore public hearings on this, preceded by a workshop for us, so that we get into grips on this. Honorable Failing made reference to the fact that some time ago, they did visit Brazil to get better exposure around biofuels. Now, most of us were unfortunately not part of that. For us to apply our minds and make a contribution, it's very logical that we get that requisite empowerment, albeit fast track. I would suggest we draw this one to a close now, but with an indication that there's still some uneasiness from the committee. A lot of questions presented to the department. We commend you tried your level best, but there's still a reflection of how essential it is for us to find what each other. If you compare this probably with the renewable energy IPP program, I mean, notwithstanding the delays, but we were able to have some understanding, you know, of what was being done. In fact, the investor reluctant first, but ended up being in. But here, there seem to be more questions than answers, and there seems to be lack of clarity in a number of areas. And it's on that basis, on our members, that I think as we move towards a break, let us just keep in mind that, we welcome the second round of the briefing, but it doesn't seem it's taking us that far to understand what exactly is happening in this sector and what are the concrete prospects. I mean, one of the things that surprised me is that all those eight companies that are listed there say that none have started any construction. You know, you start asking now exactly. You know, given the fact that there's such a pressure on our government, on the leadership, to ensure that the economy turns around, where are the gaps? What contribution can we make to make sure that that becomes a reality? Let's close with that. Thanks very much, Mr. Kieser. All members, let's take a 10-minute break. But I just wanted to, as we write, I see... You have not made any arrangement for the biomass site. Now, I said in my request, let's have biofuel and biomass, particularly in the context of the integrated resource plan. Amongst energy sources and carriers, that's one area we have not handled. So there was a clear, you know, distinct reason why we wanted an input on biomass. And it's unfortunate that that was not provided to us. Thanks very much, Mr.
Kabazela, are you ready?
Honourable members, we are going to take up transformation on gas. It's not the first time, it's a follow-up from the briefing that we got last year, but once again, it's because of the keenness to ensure that we keep our finger on the pulse in terms of the gas industry. The first 2 days were an intensive workshop with our counterparts on the Pan-African Parliament, and we had the Professor El Misri, who has the energy program in NEPAD, and his input about energy programs in Africa. One of the highlights was the extent to which some of the key priorities, energy priorities in NEPAD, are focusing on gas. And definitely as part of Africa, I'm sure we need to see the extent to which we are investing or the facilitation to invest in the gas industry. I want to steal your thunder, Mr. Giza. It's your turn now to take us through, and particularly please indicate from the last time we met to what has been the improvement or what has stalled. We frankly would like to get that from the horse's mouth. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. Thank you, members of the committee. My presentation will include the introduction and then talk to the challenges for South African market analysis and look at international benchmarking, the strategic intervention that the department is embarking on, and the subsidy considerations, pricing issues, look at the benefits of increased LPG usage, then transformation issues, and way forward and closure. With this, I hope to be able to cover the overall transformation issues in terms of policy legislation and regulation. Investments, the economic spin-off, as well as focus on the BBBE, challenges experienced in the sector, global comparison of contribution to energy supply, the progressive market penetration intent, as well as the gas prices and the extent of inclusion of gas infrastructure in the city, and then prospects of sourcing gas from globally. The liquefied program gas, also known as LPG or GPL when in French, and then the also for short, sometimes written as LP gas. It is a similar mixture of hydrocarbon gases, mainly being propane and butane. This is a carbon chain of 3 and a carbon chain of 4 straight chains in terms of the chemical composition, where with some of the butanes also included, but mainly these are the two. Sometimes it can be sold as propane means only butane. Is used as a fuel for cooking, heating, and commercial appliances, as well as sometimes used for vehicle propulsion. For the latter case, which is vehicle propulsion, it is then termed as autogas. I know, for example, there is one company here called Bulgas in Cape Town that is looking at supply of the LPG used for propulsion of vehicles, and also SAF through Sanedi are looking also at the test together with the housing department, government, in terms of using LPG for vehicle propulsion. There are other, we are also looking at gas as in terms of natural gas being used for vehicle propulsion. I know the ITC is also looking at that, and we had some meetings with them last week in terms of what needs to be done, because the framework does not currently speak in a proactive manner in terms of how to deal with that on a large scale. because we have been more concerned with gas used for cooking, heating and commercial appliances, as we are even short of that gas for that particular primary purpose. This gas then is a boiling point at room temperature, it's more than room temperature, and therefore it exists as a gas, and for each to be transported with ease and in large volumes, it needs to be pressurized to liquefy it. A procedure to apply pressure to a gas, use compression, it then liquefies. And that is why it's called then liquefied petroleum gas. It's supplied in the pressurized steel vessels, which are with terms LPG cylinders or bottles, which are typically filled to 80 or 85% of the capacity to allow for thermal expansion of this liquid inside that bottle. The typical volume is a typical volume from vaporized gas to liquefied gas in a ratio of about 250 to 1. The advantages of LPG is that it emits less carbon dioxide emissions than coal and 20% less than heating oil. And therefore, it helps to improve indoor and outdoor air quality by substantially reducing pollutants, which are hazardous to health, as well as the sulfur oxides and the nitrogen oxides and then particulate matter compared to other fuels. It can be produced two ways. One, during the refining of petroleum or crude oil, where it is extracted from petroleum or natural gas streams. It is extracted from petroleum, or it will be derived from natural gas streams as they emerge from the ground. For us as a country, we only use the first one, which is the petroleum coming from the refineries. That is our main source of LPG at the refineries. And then the refineries, which is a core, it is a byproduct of what we call a co-product of refining. Globally, we find that there's about 3% of the crude oil, from a barrel of crude oil, you get LPG. And then, but you can change the product mix such that it can even go as high as 40%. But that tends not to be profitable for most of the time because these components can also form part of the components of petrol. It is the, what is called the light end of petrol, and it's dependent on the vapor pressure. The more light the petrol is, the more it vaporizes and escapes as fuel. So they tend to be, in the summer when it is hot, to require less of these light ends that can be evaporated. And therefore, that is why you've got in winter, where they can take more LPG into petrol. When we need LPG most, they can put it into petrol. When we don't need LPG most for heating, they also do need it to put it into petrol. So there is that kind of a situation in the country. As I said, that LPG is primarily made up of propane and butane, whereas natural gas, which is the gas that we get also from Mozambique, and the gas that is used for the plant in Mose Bay, petrol plant, the gas to liquid facility in Mose Bay, it uses ethane, methane and ethane, the lighter part. So we talk of gas, but there's LPG, the focus here is going to be LPG. I'll be touching also the issue pertaining to gas in general. In terms of the South African situation, our supply is characterized by unequal access to modern energy, such as electricity and LPG, hence embarking on an electricity for an electrification program, as well as also looking at also the alternative, as well as also the alternative free basic energy, to look at the alternative energies like LPG that can be used. We also got low-income households lacking access to affordable, safe, and cleaner energy sources for cooking and space heating. The issues of accessibility and affordability are also hand in glove, because what you cannot afford, even if it's there, it remains inaccessible to you. The power shortfalls of recent years have emphasized the need for an energy mix that reduces heavy dependence on electricity. And government has identified LPG as an alternative energy graph choice for household thermal needs, which is how the cooking and heating. Then the LPG can provide future solution to household energy requirements, of which is supplied mainly by the refinery. So before even going further, we are challenged by the fact that we lack availability of LPG domestically to be able to expand this sector. So it becomes problematic to say, how can you promote something that you do not have? And then, as I said, locally we're dependent, but make us aware that we're constrained also when it comes to LPG import and storage infrastructure. And generally, there are also major increasing energy costs, which also make the situation very difficult because we talk of affordability once we see prices going. And when it comes to the transformation, there's also a challenge in terms of transformation. We've got an industry that sometimes still seems to be seeking to distance itself from the liquid fuel industry charter. Because refineries, in terms of LPG, they make up the upstream portion of the LPG value chain. There's also a question of integration, there's vertical integration. There are LPG suppliers or marketers that are linked to refineries, making it difficult for new players that want to come in the supply, in the marketing space, the distribution space, who they, for all intents and purposes, they will be competing with the same marketing arms of these refineries that produce LPG. Then the safety concern that is also there, there are safety concerns, but chief among them is the issue that LPG is perceived as very unsafe because when there is an accident, it's a bomb, it's like a bomb, and therefore people become very scared of LPG. Then in the industry itself, there's a big problem around cylinder management, where you find that some people are using holding of cylinders to put others on the market and to really compete with others. That also becomes a challenge to such an extent that when we are meeting with the industry and discussing these issues pertaining to LPG, I think once we have gone through the agenda item of cylinder management, then it's like you don't have a meeting anymore. And when it comes to cylinder management, is that we really have not found a solution to the issues there, because we cannot allow cross-feeding. Someone feels a cylinder the other, because if there's any accident, you use the person's name in the cylinder to trace and say who's responsible to rectify the situation, because if the PPE cylinder total cannot be held responsible for that, you need to be able to trace back to them. So the whole issue of cylinders is still a challenge. When it comes to the use of energy sources by education data, this just says to demonstrate that of the electrified household we've got here, those that are electrified, they use 100%, they use electricity, but there is 2% that still use that still use electricity, although they are not electrified, which means that there is non-electrified households that are illegally connecting or taping to neighbors who they pay or not to use that. As you can see, the vertical axis, there is a total number of households on the percentage scale. And if you look at gas, those that are electrified, 19% they use the gas, and then 12% of non-electrified they use gas. So there is a usage of gas which is higher than if you compare things like solar in the country and the use of car batteries and generators. But they see the use of paraffin and candles and firewood, which from an indoor pollution viewpoint, one would like to motivate those people to use more gas and firewood instead of firewood, also to have gas being used there. If you also look here in terms of when it comes to cooking, you see the same trend, but just different numbers. These numbers were derived from the survey that was conducted by the department under the electrification process to look at what is main sources to household use. And as you can see, compared to paraffin that has got 50 of the non-electrified household that is using paraffin, you've got the 4% using gas. But that also talks to the issue of the availability of the gas as well as the price thereof. Here, it just indicates the LPG market and the analysis in terms of the demand. So it's all like, but still the figures are still around the range, that we are not even gone beyond 420 in terms of the 420,000 tons of SPG produced. So the consumption currently is around 365, but still is below 420. That the difference in consumption is also due to refinery outages in some instances, and also that is being met by importation. I think you also can see, just to demonstrate the that we use for heating now in the country, with 59% being used for electricity. And then this consumption is influenced by the price of electricity, and with the increasing electricity tariff, there should be uptake on LPG. But the challenge of availability is one that we need to deal with, and pricing thereof. And the same for cooking, it seems like just made differently for cooking compared to what we had initially. Then, from 14 July 2010, the government is regulating the maximum retail price of LPG supplied to a special customer. It provides some flexibility in terms of this price and allows consumers to plan the future related energy agency's behavior. The supply factors for LPG are linked to the type of feedstock or crude oil diet that is used in a refinery. As I alluded to, the pressure specifications for petrol, that in winter you need to have, you can include more light ends, which means you can still have a liquid bit of butane and propane, which is a little bit of LPG included into the petrol. But in summer, you need to back that one out, which poses further challenges when from a domestic supply viewpoint. Refinery economics also, in terms of LPG ends getting into petrol, giving you better margin than the LPG component going towards LPG, which does not give you as high. And then the complexity of these refineries and their LPG conversion ability to convert. Then the other thing is the availability of import, storage, and distribution infrastructure. That is a big challenge, because it also talks to the issue of throughput, where you are not able to get a lot of high peak vessels coming to the country to deliver the parcels of LPG to be consumed locally. And then there are also environmental regulations which also determine how quickly we can set up this infrastructure. Or if there is infrastructure that is being looked at in terms of building at Sardana, as well as also there are two companies that are involved. The other company has already brought in some bullets and is still going to wait until the Saavedra, they are going to wait until they have gone through the statutory, they met all the statutory requirements to be able to then connect all those bullets and supply LPG. It's also the issue of local manufacturing of LPG cylinders. There is one company that is Rumehold that has already got IDC's support, financial support to be able to construct, to manufacture these cylinders, which is Mampo Gas and Energy. When it comes to the supply value chain, the supply value chain comprises of refineries, distributors, retailers, and other stockists. There are a large number of wholesalers, which are not known, all of them. But the major wholesalers and factories include Afrox, BP, which has since sold its business, and EasyGas, done the same, and TotalGas and Reactive. There are approximately 452 dealers, mainly comprising fuel stations, which form distribution chain, and 14,000 small dealers, less than from informal shops and trading stores. So the industry is fragmented between retailers and dealers. This business really yields a large portion of turnover. The dealers are contracted and branded to a particular producer or wholesaler who owns storage and filling equipment. The dealers are supplied by this branded cylinders. This is primarily a cash business, and retail LPG is a premium by refilling and user-owned small cylinders. So it's a more specialized market, but also having its own challenges in terms of the turnovers. The transportation and storage cost of supply chain results in higher price of LPG being sold to consumers. The small market size has warranted large scale infrastructure investment for importation and local optimization and distribution of bad LPG. So we were saying, don't transport a lot of LPG in small cylinders because you are transporting the steel less of the LPG. In terms of the international benchmarking, we've noted that countries like Brazil have got approximately 42 million households using LPG in their residential set. They practice the cross-subsidy scheme for several decades in order to make LPG affordable to households. The subsidy voucher system was used in expanding and making LPG available to lower-income households, respectively. In India, 162 million households use LPG for cooking. The government of India removed all subsidies on petrol for LPG. So there is an issue of subsidization that is taking place in those countries. The same here applies for Indonesia, which achieved more than 5.3 million users of LPG in their program, where government is pushing packages comprising 3 kilogram cylinder stoves and free gas at Fairfield, which enables the kickstarting of the LPG utilization in this country. This slide just serves to indicate the trade flows in terms of the increasing trade, and the trade that is decreasing coming out of Africa, going into North America. And the issue is that as a country, if there is any growth in terms of LPG consumption, that growth can only emanate from importation because we are constrained from domestic supply. So in terms of that, we have then to look, because the advantage is that at the time when we need LPG most, it is summer, you know, the hemisphere, and therefore we can get LPG, and when we don't need much, we need it more. So from that end, it is possible that we can look at the international market to get LPG. When it comes to the prices of LPG, as in December 2010, when we look at this comparison, it shows that South Africa has got the highest one among the you see the higher price. If you look that, we've got 2.54 US cents US dollar, sorry, per kilogram. The highest one being Turkey with 3.26 US dollars per kilogram. And then you look at Morocco, which has got 0.4, which is much lower than ourselves. But those countries also having ready supply of LPG compared to us. And then if you also go to the issue of the share of household income required to be spent on LPG for regular use, if you go to the almost the middle, you see that you are sitting almost there, the middle of our, when compared to countries like Kenya, Vietnam, which are high up there in terms of percentage. There are also a lot of other factors that will come into that in terms of also our living standards. But on the scene, it's a relatively, it's not a very low. And then when it comes to the strategic intervention that we want to embark on to be able to deal with this, we need to then develop an LPG expansion strategy. We commenced the development of the strategy, but it was put on hold last year because we had, looking at our capacity constraints in the department, we said we needed to look at LPG supply issues so that we can be able to at least get the winter that is not so having so much shortages of LPG like the previous one. And indeed, the shortages last year were kind of abated. And we have, however, incorporated this strategy this financial year, and it will be delivered in this financial year. We, however, note that there are also other things that are on the go, for example, development of the Port of Saldanha in terms of provision of facilities for LPG, where Standard Energy is working. And we've said to ourselves we need to look at those quick wins and also be able to identify them and implement them without waiting for the strategy to come to the end, to be concluded. The target is that 1.5 households for all income also by a period of 5 years, and to provide access to safe, clean, efficient, environmentally clean, and affordable thermal fuel. This will, however, also involve some kind of switching costs, because you need, people are using, you've got electricity, stove that uses electricity, and when they switch to LPG, you find that the stoves for LPG, for example, tend to be on the high side compared to electricity stoves. And then also to enhance the level and quality of energy services currently available to residential users. And LPG, as Andrew said earlier on, in terms of the greenhouse gas emissions, which is lower than fuel oil as well as coal, is that it helps in terms of the green economy programs that aim to reduce this greenhouse gas emission. Other thing is to avoid any mixing of cylinders by competing companies and swapping of cylinders, as well as the holding of cylinders, where one company just keeps another company's cylinder and sort them out of the market. And then to expedite local manufacturing of LPG cylinders and appliances. And then is to be able to launch also a campaign together with the players, as well as the LPG association to assist the development of the LPG market. This is subject to concrete plans on ensuring security of supply. Then we need to also investigate the possibility of eradicating the dependence of LPG association on voluntary member contributions, because if that association is able to deal with all the safety issues and we ensure that it is viable on its own, that will also help, because they are the ones that are going to assist in terms of ensuring safety around LPG issue, because one incident can just wipe out the goodwill that we could have managed to get from the public. So we also need to cooperate with COPTA to ensure encouragement of different municipalities to support the rollout of the project throughout the country, and then Department of Environmental Affairs regarding the prioritization of assessment of the environmental impact of these projects. And engagement also with National Treasury regarding possible subsidies in this regard. Then also NERSA, these are our strategic partners, as well as the IDC, regarding support program for the expanded use of LPG in the energy area. Not leaving outside the Transnet, particular Transnet National Coast Authority, to facilitate the development of import infrastructure at the identified ports, being here mainly Saldanha and also Richards Bay. In terms of the price, as we see, the price for LPG in coastal zone 1A, which is the Durban area, is 22.58 per kilogram, and then we've got here being 24.40 in the inland zone, made up of the maximum refinery gate price, and then you add the transport, primary transport cost, the operating expenses, the working capital, as well as depreciation. This is the mechanism that came into effect on the 10th of July 2010. But this one, the figures here are the current figures which are going to be enforced until the 3rd of September 2013, where you can see that the refinery gate price that you have indicated here is the one that is still has not yet been reviewed. We are in the process of reviewing this refinery gate price. We published the discussion document to look at this refinery gate price. We also held a stakeholder workshop once we had received all the comments. The comments that we have received now post the workshop are being duly considered for inclusion into the final position paper, which final position paper will be issued before December this year. The other thing that we also wanted to look, if I can go back, we also want to review this the working rules that we deal with all these elements, the line items in terms of primary storage, transport costs, operating expenses, and working capital, so that they can also be self-adjusting, that we don't wait until there is a review, that we put certain measures in place to say if certain things change, then the price will automatically adjust so that we are able to incorporate changes in the industry landscape in terms of the cost involved. So the internal drafting of that is being finalized, and the revised working rules will be published or public comment during the quarter around October, the plan that we should be publish them for public comment. The benefits of increased LPG usage include the savings in electricity consumption. As we have said, we are looking at the displacement of electricity by way of use of the LPG in the residential sector, to contribute also to the green economy, and also the versatility, because LPG can be transported by sea, rail, or road, and efficiency, because LPG has got a higher calorific value. It's more, it's higher heating value, by putting it like that, than other commonly used fuel. And it's also in terms of reduced energy poverty, in terms of allowing the modern alternative energies to be also accessible to our households, or indigenous households. In terms of the way forward, in terms of this, is to look at the conclusion of this MRGP. We need to conclude the MRGP, as already alluded, in terms of the time frame that we are looking at. Because once the MRGP is completed, it will work more like having already the indicators. The MRGP is going to be like you said, the basic fuel price, particularly for LPG, and not have it linked to the 93 octane, as currently is the case, that we also enable the importation of LPG based on the import parity pricing mechanism. And also to deal with the working rules for the maximum retail price of LPG, because the MRGP, which is the refined price, serves as a base on which all these pricing elements then build up into also a final price, the retail price. The other issue that we need to deal with is the conclusion of the LPG expansion strategy, where we also need to identify the equipment and facilitation of infrastructure development. Even in terms of our international, bilateral, with Algeria, in terms of the agreement that does exist with Algeria, issues of LPG are included. We also looking at getting LPG in terms of other countries. The other companies have all indicated countries where they specifically will source their LPG, and also requiring also the assistance of government where possible for them to expand the allocation, because what they indicated was that some already have the allocation of LPG. We need now to deal with the environmental issues and the development of their respective projects. The other issue that we need to deal with pertains particularly to transformation issues. Some of us will recall that there was a liquid fuels industry charter combined audit that was done published last year. It was published on the 5th of July 2012. And in terms of that, it did not have, there is no specific LPG industry audit of performance on empowerment that was conducted. Partly also that they felt that LPG is a byproduct or co-product of refining, which is the sole source of locally manufactured LPG. The bottom four performing elements with respect to all the LSE and DEE were enterprise development, skills development, employment equity, as well as preferential crude procurement. That is now in the whole charter for the liquid fuels. So the issue of the technical skills transfer is also a big problem, because people that participate in the industry are then able to then later on, based on their experience, go on and establish SMEs that will have an active participation in the industry itself. And the 10 entrepreneurs were not capacitated through enterprise recruitment or trial or gradual improvement procurement level to afford them some kind of experience that will be able to put them on some platform to move to greater things. And then the high scoring areas that were identified are those that are critical to remain and involve only a few beneficiaries. But those areas where there wasn't achievement generally take long to set up and implement, but they have a wider reach. What was initially envisaged was fair ownership of assets across the value chain by historically disadvantaged South African entrepreneurs who are significant players in the South African oil sector. But what was achieved was partial ownership of some assets by serial investors who are not necessarily involved in key operations within the sector itself. So it becomes serial investors and not people that will be entrenched in the industry based also on their knowledge and participation in that particular sector. There is also support of other entrepreneurs, including retailers and wholesalers, was also wanting. With that, the minister conducted bilateral engagements with all auditors, and it was evident that since 2010-2011, the audit was done there. There were some strides to correct some of the worst performing strategic focus areas of the charter. One example was the appointment of men in key positions, in positions of these companies. There was crude oil procurement through a women-owned company, VASA, that speaks to agents also in particular, and the merchants of retail gas that is now in the LPG gas space, which mainly with agents. Some areas, such as ownership, might take longer as they need to identify the partner with appropriate creation and not just serial investors, but those with knowledge, skills, and who are operationally involved. So that's what has happened in the case space when it comes to transformation. And as informed by this recommendation, the DOE also seeks to align the charter with the BE framework to ensure that it is measurable and also while retaining all the cornerstones of the charter to ensure that the generic triple BE codes are also accommodated. This audit results, they coincided, the publishing of the, coincided with the amendment of the BE code that's gazetted on the 5th of October last year for a 60-day commentary period. It was then necessary that the department give way to this process, to let this process of the codes unfold, as it was critical in aligning the LSC with the EU. So alignment will commence as soon as proposed program for transformation is established and adequately resourced. Maybe if I can touch on some of these companies, because we've got the Readile, which is a black-owned investment holding company that was formed in 2003, which has got ownership by the M3 Investment and the Standard Bank having some holding there. It has also acquired significant stake in Vopec, which is one of the leading storage companies in the country. We also have got in our space Kaya Gas, which is a black-owned LPGS power gas in the distribution company, founded in 2006 by Mr. Tatang Shibalana and Bukadi. They also owned a broad base of individuals, with main institutional shareholders being Cardis, IDC, and Makana Trust. And also, we also have another company here, which is Avedia, the one I've alluded to, which also is owned by a whole base of black individuals with many institutional shareholders. Then this company aims to also bring bulk storage and cylinder filling facility. They've got one that we established in 2011 in Black Hill, and they're further cementing their position in the market. And then on November 2010, they conducted first importation of LPG by ship into the port of Sudan to deal with LPG supply shortages. They are the ones that have already brought some bullets that they have not installed and are first going to complete the statutory requirements, get all required licenses before they can proceed with their project. We also have a situation here where we've got leading supplier and distributor of PG to Southern African market for the past 10 years being EasyGas, which is used to be a Shell-owned LPG gas company. Now it is a 100% owned company by Rubis Energy from France, which for me sometimes it's very concerning in terms of whether I will move it right in terms of empowerment or not. And then we've also got Afro, which is also a B rated company by Empowerdesk. It's currently rated at BBB in terms of the codes. It is also a market leader in terms of gases and welding products. It was founded in 1927 and is listed in the JSE in 1963. It operates in South Africa and 10 other African countries, and it manages 5 other African operations on behalf of Linde Group, which is its mother company. The other company of note here is that we also know that BP and Masana Petroleum Solutions, in which BP has a 35% stake, announced that Orange Energy has agreed to buy their LPG distribution business in South Africa. The deal is expected to be completed during the third quarter of 2015, subject to the completion of all required legal and regulatory approvals. There is also the woman-owned company that seeks to build cylinders in the country. That I've already earlier on. That is what has happened in the transformation space in the LPG industry. And I think what will have to take matters further is to conclude the process of the alignment of the B codes with our charter, because the charter currently it is law being annexed into the Petroleum Products Act. That is all that I can say for now. I'll wait maybe for further clarification.
Done. Thank you very much. Since this is the usual hand over to member, but I can't wait but just to say to me, just creating a good framework when responding to our questions and clarity seeking, can you share with us what are the key features, what would you regard the performance indicators with regard to the transformation of the gas industry? I just want to settle my mind on that before I come with a whole plethora of questions. All right, members, over to you. Mativela, Prof, Honorable Fading, Mafexin, in that order.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, mine is a question on the building of cylinders, because I remember some time ago we were talking about local manufacturers and how far are we except of this woman who is intending to build gas cylinders. And the other one is about Mr. Mkhize spoke about the cylinders that belongs to companies so that you can be able to trace if there is a fault. And what happens to the cylinders? What about the cylinders that we buy from hardware? What happens to those? Because they sell them at the hardware, we buy them and we go and fill them, but it don't say it comes from which company. What happens? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. Mine is just a technical one. I think one of the disadvantages of LPG cylinders, their weight. I'm trying to say, with the technology, do they have to be that heavy in order to contain this gas? Is there a way of making them lighter? I'm again trying to take around this problem of mixing and what is. I went to Lansdowne, I have Afrox and another, I don't know what the second one is. Afrox is usually cheaper. But with this avoiding of changing standards, what I'm trying to grapple with now is the content inside of this cylinder, whether it is BP or Afrox or total, is what is inside different. If it is not different, it's the same. Is the problem Afrox putting this in BP? Because you can trace the cylinder itself, wherever it is. If you can just enlighten me on that. Why do we have to take a BP cylinder to BP? Because if there's any explosion anywhere, you'll know that this bottle came from that thing.
Thank you, Chair. It's a subject quite close to my heart because I do think a transformation needs to occur, particularly in this space, not necessarily around LPG, but around our kind of household energy strategy, which we still don't have. And I think it's one of my problems with the presentation today. I see the information you're presenting. Unfortunately, it seems to be a kind of snapshot of where we are. It's not really giving us an indication of how we move from here to what the optimal outcome is and how we get to that optimal outcome. And I suppose that will come through the LPG expansion strategy. I presume that's how you're going to answer me. But the point is, we have been waiting for a long time for this, and I'll be interested to see what comes out of that. But I'm also interested to see how that links up with the broader integrated energy plan as well. Because I think one of the problems that we've seen in the sector is that government has kind of like intervened at various times and come with certain things to address certain issues, such as the high price of LPG. And you've come in and you've intervened and set the maximum retail price, but then haven't actually regulated anywhere else in the value chain. And all that leads to is a shortage of gas. And I know because I buy gas as well. So, so the point is that when we look at this issue, I think this has a huge potential to transform our energy sector in South Africa, not just LPG, but the way that particularly poor households consume energy. And it can also fit into energy efficiency, as you say. But we need to have a comprehensive strategy that specifically looks at the kinds of externalities, both the negative externalities of our current energy usage, such as coal and such as paraffin, that poor households use. How do we reduce that over the long term? How do we transition across? What kind of subsidies should be given to do that? How do we use mechanisms such as the free basic electricity and change it to free basic energy? All of those particular issues need to be addressed. So I'm interested to see what comes from this particular strategy. Just to answer, in fact, my colleague's question around the size of canisters, without mentioning the company's name, we did in fact do an oversight to one of the companies that they're producing a 3 kilogram canister at the moment. And in fact, they're also allowing people to only fill to 1 kilogram. So that starts to get over the kind of problems we have in terms of relation to paraffin, where people can buy a small amount, they don't have to spend a huge amount of money buying a big amount. So I think we are able to overcome these obstacles, but I'm waiting to see what the actual final strategy will be, and I think we all are. Clearly we also need to look at importation. This is obviously the big problem that we have in terms of an expansion of LPG. But there seems to be problems around the tender in Saldanha, particularly in terms of building up this importation terminal and which companies are allowed to actually operate from there as well and get access to that gas. I don't know if you have any more information around that. What are the issues around that? Is that going ahead? And what are the particular delays, if you can, to speak to that?
Just before we move to Mark Ferguson, can I just make it formal? Can we get a full report on the Saldanha Bay procurement? A full report. Who applied for the tender, when, and who got the tender? A full report. Thank you. Mark Ferguson.
Thank you, Chair. We've been speaking about this a lot, and we've been speaking about the continuous talks on awareness and communications in communities and things like this. But that's still priced too high for the England. It's priced too high for our people. And Dr. Faber spoke about how you can really literally go buy a little bottle of paraffin as opposed to a 3 kilogram cylinder of gas. What is the strategy for us to deliver to the indigenous people? And would we consider possibly the Brazilian model of the cross-subsidy scheme, much like in Brazil? I'm not sure. I'm just putting these things out as a comment. And then, have we done a study possibly on using gas, geysers as opposed to solar geysers, because they're supposed to be cheaper? I know I've used gas geysers. It works extremely well, but it's just something that I think we also should look at. But unfortunately, it's all in the absence of us having our conclusive national strategy. Also, just want to comment on the local manufacturer of cylinders. How far have we gone down the line, except for the one manufacturer whom you speak of? Are there other people, are we creating an enabling environment for particularly the empowerment of new entrants in both the manufacture of cylinders and the resale of gas? What kind of enabling environment are we creating? And then we do speak about households all the time, and that we are targeting. But what about industry taking the take-up of using gas for their heating? Is the DOE looking at any kinds of mechanisms to ensure industry converts to this? And obviously, this is largely dependent on gas supply. So those are just some of the comments that I'd like to make. Thanks, Chair.
Matindo, followed by that is Lau, then Honorable Smale, and then Jatilok.
Thanks, Chair. since 2008, when the Western Cape in particular experienced blackouts and load shedding, I think there's not much transformation that has happened in the gas business. And also, the only transformation I see is the price increase. it's a miracle to afford the price of gas. Whereas it's really an alternative when it comes to this kind of weather, especially in the Western Cape. There were pilot projects also that you introduced in Khayelitsha and Langa. What have you learned from from those pilot projects? Besides giving people free gas, what have you learned from those pilot projects? Thank you.
I have a couple of questions, mainly questions of clarity, but if some of them are difficult, I'm sorry about that. The issue of regulatory framework in the gas industry, I can see the price is regulated. I'll still come to pricing. But what is the relationship between NERFA, which is the National Energy Regulator of South Africa, establishing the Energy Department? What is the relationship of this institution with the regulatory framework of the gas? Who regulates the gas? And what is regulated in the gas? Is it only the price, or are there any other areas regulated? The business model of trading with gas in South Africa, from this, what I am able to get is that the role players are very free. They just play the game on their own level. From the manufacturer to the wholesaler, from the wholesaler to the retailer to consumer, it's just a free for all activity. We don't even have an understanding as the Department of Energy of who are the people that are playing this game there. We don't know. This is what the report says. There are too many players involved there. Prices are just being put there in any way they could. Can I get clarity around the business model that we have? How do we trade this case in South Africa locally, but not exporting or importing it? That local business between when gas is made and put in cylinders to when it gets used by the consumer. Do we have a database of the role players? Or do we know who is playing there? And is there any amount of transformation that we believe is necessary there? In my view, yes. There is a need to transform the particular area drastically. But the last two questions, Chairman, would be the issue of the energy centers. What is the relationship between the energy centers? My observation is that these energy centers are also left as at the discretion of those who trade with petrol, more particularly. The petrol filling stations and those companies that are in there, like Petrol SA is there, Total is there, Shell has done a few of them and so on. And they decide where they want to put up this thing. They make a choice of the one who wants to put it in Kulu because that's where our icon Nelson Mandela comes from. And then he puts it there and that's it. Then the other one put it in Bizana because he has a particular interest. And then somebody put one in, say, and then there's nobody worried about whether these things are a success story or they are a failure or whether these things can create business. No guidance, no advice on, or no business case made about these energy centers. And in my view, that's a potential serious business for cooperatives, potential serious business for the SMEs. But that area is not taken into cognizance. And this gas presentation and the energy centers, where do they get together? How do they relate? Or how do we view energy centers as one of the areas that could be centers for the trading of gas? That's the issue of pricing. When one look at the slide here, which talks about the primary transport cost of 32.120 for the coastal area and 175.960 in the inland. I'm not able to make sense of what informs this big difference. I think it's about 500% difference here. And the retail margin, the retail margin of 258 in the coastal areas at 279 in the inlet area. What criteria is used to determine these differences? I think those are the few questions, Jefferson, for the first round.
Unfortunately, it's 20-1. You can't have a second round. Honourable Smith.
Chairperson, yes. With the terminal builds that are taking place at Saldanha of storage, we're looking at an increased capacity of around about 80%, 8,000 megatons, which is equivalent to about 80% extra storage of what we are currently holding. Now, a lot was mentioned about prices linked to the availability and to security of supply. Is this going to actually have an influence on price? One. Two. Are we looking at long-term supply towards away from coastal towards inland storage capacity from inland, or from coastal to inland? And are we really looking at possibilities at future pipelines in order to diversify from to industrialize the uptake or the gas uptake into industrialization? I won't repeat what other people say. It might be in a different way, but for the sake of time.
Thank you very much for that, Honorable Smiley.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think most of the information that's presented to us today is not new, which I don't have a problem with. But I'm just saying, for the purpose of us playing an oversight role over the department, important for you to indicate the milestones that we achieved, so that when we meet, we shouldn't be talking about building the porch facilities in Saldanha. But you need to be able to report on the progress made, and it'd be far easier for us to play an oversight role. I think it applies the same to the previous presentation, because most of the, actually you are quite correct, I went back and googled the presentation that was made in January. It was basically the same, with few exceptions. I think it's important for the department, when they appear before us, to indicate this is what will be in the next 6 months, next 8 months, this is what will be aiming to achieve, so that we can judge whether they have met those targets. Otherwise, they will rehash the same story all the time, and I think it would be a chance. But just about my last question, it's related to that of Honorable Slau, around the regulatory model that you invested to build as the department. There are certain aspects of regulation that fall within your ambit, but there are those that have been allocated to NASA. Are you envisaging a situation where all regulatory work around gas would be done by NASA? If not, why do you want to continue with a model which is fractured to the extent that some of the responsibility will be allocated to you and others to NASA?
Thank you very much, Honorable Nautos. Thank you very much, Honorable Nautos. I'm sure, because I have heard particularly what Madam Nautos said, he resonates what I said at the very beginning. I didn't want to speak to the Honorable Member, but I said nicely, give us the key features of transformation, including the performance indicators. Then we'll be happy. Because I could sense, as I said, even last year, we were unhappy about the report that we got, because we were saying very little, if anything. But anyway, the ball is in your court now. Over to you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you very much, Honorable Members, for your questions, which will assist the process going forward. In terms of the performance indicators, is to say that there are issues of ownership and control, issues of supply development, the measurements thereof. These are the things that are outlined in the chart in terms of the ownership and the like, economic empowerment, which must be clearly articulated specifically for the LPG industry, which work will be part of what entails alignment with the codes. When it comes to the role of the department in as far as regulation is concerned, I think there's been clarity around the issue of saying that going forward, in looking to the future, we should be left with the policy issues, and then the regulatory aspects will be dealt with by NERSA. What is currently happening is that we are regulating the price of all the fuels that are being regulated, including petrol, diesel, paraffin, as well as LPG. And NERSA issued licenses regarding the construction as well as the operation of these the pieces of infrastructure that are being developed. So NERSA has got its role to play, and we've got our role, and then it's at the issues of tariff that is done by the regulator responsible for Petron Pipelines. It is done under the Petron Pipelines Act. But as was said, that is a function that will later be migrated to NASA in terms of the regulation of the price as well, in as much as all other other liquid fuels. The when we say that we don't know the numbers, it's not from a point of saying that we don't have them, because at wholesale level, the manufacturing level, they are licensed. Is the same situation with paraffin, that you've got paraffin shops all over that are also distributing paraffin in the same vein with this albeit that there is much done much safer, but it's almost the same thing here when we're talking of not necessarily say that we're throwing our hands in the air when we say we're not doing anything to it. We do have the list of those people, otherwise I would not even be citing some of them that I've got here. Then when it comes to the issues also of IECs, I think the relationship between IECs and FPG, as I've explained, is that the distribution center for FPG is also the retail, the petrol service stations. Those and IEC is in the main that kind of an institution, and they do distribute FPG. In some of the IEC, for example, Ratlo, there was a company that came also to sponsor in terms of the FPG supply, right? So LPG is part of that. The issues of failures of the where there is failure for IECs, in terms of the presentation that you once made, we alluded to where problems are, which pertain also to the how the ownership model also being one of the contributing factors to say the governments have given them an option to also look at other ownership structures that can help to ensure that there is sustainability. And we also raise the issue of continual training and retraining of the members of the cooperatives to ensure that this is sustainable, and the training of these people. It's not that there is no business case that these companies willy-nilly choose a place. If they the choice, they would a choice that is within at certain parameters to say that this you can choose in this area because it is area where there is a need for them, and a need assessment is done to ensure that there is a need for a particular IEC. So there is an opportunity to also improve in terms of the IECs, because we're saying that we're looking at them as energy centers and not just as petrol and diesel distribution centers. And then the criteria that was used for the transport cost, the difference from inlet to coastal, that was used, what is happening in general, even for petrol and diesel, the price for coastal is different from inlet, because there is this cost that you accumulate as you move through different material districts. And based on the tracking that you use to track this, to ferry this thing to transport it to the inlet region, you will find that the cost will go up as you move from the coast to inland. It is part of what is in the working rules and part of what we say also want to revise going forward and ensure that it is also self-adjusting on its own. We, in terms of the business model that we're looking at the department, we wanted also picking on things that we have learned from the pilots, is that it's important that we bring the bus coverage closer to the people and not have a situation where the transportation is mainly on the steel. Whereas was alluded earlier on that the steel is heavier, and then the transportation of that, you're spending a lot of energy transporting the steel instead of letting the steel be closer to the people and the distribution to be nearer, because LPG is also another challenge that is used. Mainly the people to procure will be the women and children, and therefore the issue of it being closer to the residential areas in terms of supply becomes important. That is the model that we had also presented in the past. I didn't want to go back to that in terms of the presentation. So that is how we look at it from a business model perspective. And then in terms of the cylinders, to say what happens with to those cylinders that are owned and then they are, you change the cylinder. If I've got an approach a cylinder, and I want to go to buy to EasyGas, I still take my Afrox cylinder, take it to EasyGas. Then EasyGas sells me, the LPG. I take that, now I've got a cylinder for EasyGas. They then must take that cylinder back to EasyGas.
That is the argument. That is where the issue of stealing the old ODI takes place, where one guy that has received all these and that are not his, instead of ensuring that he's able to take them back to them, what happens, he just keeps them. This other guy now is left without a cylinder, because his cylinders have been hoarded or been kept by this guy here. That is where the issue of cylinders come in. So you can still buy LPG from another supplier with a different cylinder. The weight of the cylinder, that when we're doing the project, they also look at the weight. I think one of the people that also proposed, if I remember, when we're doing the pilot, was also looking at fiber content or something, cylinder, to deal with the issues of the weight. But that is still, it's not really entrenched working well currently. But it is a matter that the manufacturers of cylinders are considering. But again, sometimes you get that, and there are also cost issues that are associated in the choice of materials, building materials. And then the full report on the Saldana, I think in terms of Saldana,
let's not discuss that now.
Okay.
We want it to write it.
Okay, I think we'll provide that. We know that is something that we're going to provide. And when it comes to solar vessels...
Or just another thing, we cannot leave it open-ended. Our members, can we be considerate enough, say that we give them 4 weeks? Surely the report is there, but let's give them 4 weeks. And it lands on our desk. Thank you.
Okay, thanks for that. The solar and vessel gas geysers, I think here it's an issue of the availability again, because we've got good radiation in the country compared to other countries. The sun is really available, but the technology could be expensive. Now on the gas side, we do have the technology, but we don't have the gas. So that is the problem with gas. And also later down the line, it would be matters also of efficiency, looking at the gas versus getting it readily there from the sun. And then the issue of industry using gas, we have looked at that, but in terms of LPG, we're not looking at LPG in isolation. There is also this LPG, the gas that is coming from Mozambique that goes through the Lili pipeline, which is the methane rich gas, which is used by commercial entities around Durban. We are in talks recently with some people that were also looking at the extension of that. We are... One of the things that we'll be doing in this financial year is the gas infrastructure development segment, the development of that, which will talk to this issue of gas and will in any event touch on the issue of LPG, because we had adopted the stance that LPG is going to be a forerunner of natural gas. Although they are not the same calorific veil, but you can do a little bit of changes and then be able to use what you use for LPG. And even natural gas is it. I think when it comes to what I learned from the, what we learned from the pilot plus, I've already indicated in terms of the pricing that we came up with in 2010, and business model has been clarified. The subsidy scheme, we're looking and saying that we're not going to only consider subsidizing the gas itself, but we need to look at subsidizing the appliances, because the appliances tend to be expensive. And it has happened when we're still doing the pilot. Sometimes, I hope you have noted in the previous presentation where there were people that were not electrified, but they still had electricity. They put in some other connections, we deal with electricity. But gas, if you don't have gas, you don't have it. There was an instance where in some household, they were provided the heater, provided the gas, but since it was there, but no man to buy gas. They didn't have the money. So these are some of the challenges that are very difficult to deal with in terms of affordability. Yeah, I think, in terms of the progress made, one of the things that I undertake is that, we, as indicated in terms of the MRGC review that we need to conclude, as well as the working group, and the expansion strategy that was put on hold, that we will provide. By the end of this year.
the last few minutes. Any follow-up questions? Oh, we seem to be fine. Thank you very much, Chair. Thanks very much, Mr. Kizavate. You know, the reason why I had a long list of questions, but I'll save them for now. Save that here. When I put them together, I can just share them by writing to you. My understanding is that transformation of the industry goes beyond just the ownership and control issues, like economic empowerment. There are a number of other issues we have raised, which I thought we were going to share, highlight, and emphasize for us so that we can have a common understanding as to what we mean about the Kishwas, Shishas, so that we can say at the end of the day, when these are achieved, then we can say this industry, as an industry, not a component. You've already alluded to LNG, because I strongly maintain that you can't just handle LPG, because it's a stream. An energy carrier that comes within the gas industry from one distinct source. And I maintain that the issues of legislation are just as important. You know, it would be helpful to hear whether the current arrangements provide efficiency for this industry. There's the Gas Act, there's the Petroleum Products Act, and even some amendments. The question I have is that, is that arrangement okay? You know, I mean, or umbrella, if it is okay, that's fine. You know, if we need to, you know, legislate or address the guessings to a multiplicity of you know, laws. But if not, we need to be clear. Infrastructure, which I see coming up strongly in the road draft of the amendment bill, which I hope you'll be bringing to us very, very soon, the MPRTA, no, it's not MPRTA, it's the, come again? No, but the Gas Amendment Act itself, Gas Amendment Act, the issue of infrastructure features very strongly, we're not, go into detail now, but also transportation. You know, when we did this offset visit, the use of transportation, road versus rail, came up very strongly. Supply chain, generally, some academics are claiming very strongly that it's a very complicated and overburdened supply chain arrangements, let's say, the refillers, the sellers, you know, each and every one of the stages in supply chain wanting to have its own margin. And by the time the product reaches the consumer, it's something else. And of course, the dilemma of vertical integration is part of that. Pricing, as in any case, as I've just alluded, governance arrangements, safety, especially for the area, I'm not saying the others, because when we went there last week, you know, we were turned into, I don't know whether I would say astronauts, with the amount of safety gear that we put on. So we really appreciate the some certain levels of the supply chain that really the seriousness. But once again, out of experience, there seems to be some compromised areas, particularly at retail level. As we have indicated, but I didn't seem that way regarding this as a feature, the use of household appliances. That was my expectation, as I say, you know, and please, it would be helpful if we could revert back to this, you know, committee with some nice, you know, 1-2 pages. Just have a common understanding so that we have a baseline information that this is what we understand as key features. And in a great deal, that would be performance indicators, as indicators, so that we can all say once these are achieved, then we know that the gas industry has been transformed. As it is now, we have the expansion strategy, and then we have a little bit here and a little bit there, a little bit there. And I don't think that's the cell phone. And just as a writer, the other thing that came up is the extent to which integrated energy centers are beginning to integrate the sale of gas. I would suggest that you interact with the committee secretary and see if the last presentation on IECs did highlight that. If not, can you get someone who handles that area to just share with us so that members would know the extent to which the existing integrated energy centers are really beginning to take up sale of gas. On that basis, honourable members, can I thank everyone and then say till the next week, 20th Tuesday, whereby we'll be looking at the restructuring of the electricity sector, and the department would be confidently now, I'm sure, everything is in place, where you can share with us the draft integrated energy plan at long last, and also we'll consider minutes and reports. On that basis, thanks very much, everyone. The meeting stands adjourned.